The BMF belt is on the line. UFC 291 coming up this weekend from Salt Lake City, Utah. So much action to go over. You are not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. And just like that, we are back and getting set for UFC 291. It's Poirier versus Gaethje, the rematch. The last time those two guys fought was way back in 2018, a fight of the year contender. If Ferguson Pettis didn't exist, it wouldn't have had any competition for that award. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right, respective socials, at Matt Allen FNP. And when we look at a card like this, I mean, there's so many big-time fighters, former title challengers, the likes of Derek Lewis and Wonderboy Thompson. You look at it, I mean, a couple of guys that had that interim belt around exactly. their waist. Not even a couple, three in the same weight class in Gaethje, Poirier, and Tony Ferguson. Only one UFC debut on this card, and keep in mind, it's at Elevation, the third overall card in Salt Lake City. Yair Rodriguez taking on Alex Caceres. That was the first one in 2016, and then, of course, last year's UFC 278, where Leon Edwards shocked the world, getting the win over Kamaru Usman. So a lot of big-time fights on this one. And I know, like, this kind of feels like it has big-time fight feels.
And I was just about to say, I know personally, I'm very excited for this card. And that's the thing. When you've been watching MMA for as long as we have, every single fight, every single weekend, I gotta be honest, there's some weeks I don't get as excited for viewing these. I can't say that about this card. I gotta be honest. I know a lot of people might be down on it because they're not fighting for an official belt in the main event, right? They are kind of throwing together that BMF title. But there's not a single person who loves watching MMA who isn't excited to see Dustin Poirier versus Justin Gaethje for the second time. That might be one of those kind of, you know, fan favorite belts, but still, those are two fighters that people get up for, and those are two guys who you know are going to put on a show.
Eight ranked fighters that are on this card, and you expect with Blagoy Ivanov, UFC roster watch, saying he's out. He's number 15. I would think Marco Sergio de Lima probably slots in at 15. We gain another ranked fighter. He's taking on, of course, the aforementioned Derek Lewis, that one UFC debut. Darius Flowers coming off a probably, and I wouldn't even say probably, the biggest episode of Contender Series from last summer. So look out for Flowers taking a fight on 10 days notice against Jake Matthews. Some big time matchups on this card. 12 total. If anything falls out, make sure you tune in here at Fight Night Picks for any of those updates. You can find us at Fight Night Picks, Instagram, and Twitter for any extra content. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Surprisingly big-time implications at flyweight coming up this weekend. Long and gone are the lofty aspirations that we all put on Miranda Maverick. And since making that awesome debut back in 2020 over Liana Jojua, a 3-3 salty record for Maverick. Coming in here taking on Priscilla Cachoeira, who just struggles to make the weight every single time.
She's like John Lineker.
Every single time, Matt. Priscilla Cachoeira is supposed to take on one Karine Silva back at the end of the winter. Entering the spring, she comes in at 130 for a 125-pound fight. Priscilla Cachoeira, you go through the entire career. What else? 129 pounds against Jillian Robertson. Got submitted in that one. Against Courtney Casey, she was scheduled to take a fight. She fell in the bathtub, allegedly. The fight is off.
Allegedly. I don't know if I wouldn't believe her.
Cutting complications. And she also had a four-month USADA suspension back in 2019 due to blood pressure issues with the medication. So if you look at it overall, Priscilla Cachoeira, a black cloud over her head since she's been in the UFC. And it's unfortunate because if you look at it, 4-4 with the promotion. She's been an underdog in every single matchup, so she's cashed in for those opportunities. You see those big-time knockouts. You see the big-time right hand, the fight of the night that she had back against Jeon Kim where she cried like it was Monster's Ball, and she gets a belt up in jiu-jitsu that had nothing to do with her striking performance. She also had a performance bonus with that big-time Marge Simpson right uppercut against Shanna Dobson. You think I didn't watch that fight today? You're right, I did.
I swear a lot for this one.
If you're looking at this fight, though, I opened it the way that I wanted to because this has big-time implications. If Miranda Maverick loses this fight, it feels like, hey, Go back and get seasoned with Invicta.
And I agree with you 100%. This is one of those fights where the loser is kind of more important for them than it is the winner, because you break it down perfectly. Priscilla Cachoeira, when you watch her skills, when you watch her in the cage, she's a fun fighter to watch, right? She has good power for the division. She's going to make some mistakes, don't get me wrong. She is much more power punching over really anything on the feet, but still, that makes for a fun style at 125 pounds because we don't often see fighters like her in this division. But this is an interesting fight because, like you said, Miranda Maverick was that golden goose. She was the prince that I guess the princess that was promised, if you will. And it has been a bit of a difficult run for her, but to her credit, a lot of those losses have been to kind of other fighters who are in that similar category as her. We have other prospects who are trying to work their way up, and that's the weird thing, right? We sometimes have cards where you'll see two or three kind of prospect v prospect fights, but Miranda Maverick, it seems like a lot of her fights have been some of those matchups. Like, look at the Erin Blanchfield one. So, for Miranda Maverick, I still think the skill set is there, and that's why I have a really hard time kind of jumping off, because I do think Maverick, if she is able to go out there and put two, maybe three impressive performances together, maybe we will see her rekindle some of that hype that she once had. But I think that's a really good point you bring up. How, if she does lose this, maybe it is time to go to Invicta and add a little bit more seasoning so that she can get that experience.
Maverick's beaten fighters that are no longer in the UFC. Maverick's lost to fighters that are in the top 15. Blanchfield is 3, and Tyler Santos is 3, so we'll say Blanchfield's ranked 4th. You also have the 8th-ranked Macy Barber. I know a lot of people thought Maverick won that fight. I did as well. And then you look at the last loss against Jasmine Jazz Davizius. That was probably one of the worst ones. Yeah. Like, she came out of the gate pretty strong, but then faded as it went on. Like, that one was a really tough fight. But if you go through it and you look at both these fighters, for Cachoeira, training at MMA Masters since early 2023, she was promised a fight against Sajara Eubanks. Eubanks struggled to make the weight. Then the Karine Silva fight, now a fight against Miranda Maverick. And this fight was thrown together on a little bit of short notice. It was announced on July 13th that out was Joanne Wood against Cachoeira. Short notice for Miranda Maverick, who competed at UFC 289 back in Vancouver not that long ago. And if you look at it for Miranda Maverick, I mean, she's kind of bounced around between gyms since she's been in the UFC. It was a lot of time at pound for pound Muay Thai, Elevation, training with Raquel Pennington, Tisha Torres, and the gals there. Training for this one at a couple of different gyms, and I'll throw them up there on the screen because you see a little bit of the land of the misfit toys. And I'm going to make a comparison in this fight, but Miranda Maverick out of, not Glory MMA and Fitness, but Marathon MMA. That's the Trey Ogden gym, training with Garrett Armfield, but also training at the Goat Shed with Jillian Robertson. And Maverick's trained with Robertson a little bit off and on, not just for this camp, but in the past as well. Maverick had that fight against Robertson, got the win. Cachoeira obviously has the fight against Robertson. It's a loss. MMA math, you know what to do. But if you do look at this one overall, a negative strike differential for Cachoeira, and it's not just because that 95-2 line against Valentina Shevchenko. She got outstruck by Jian Kim. She went out there, did Cachoeira her last time out, looked great against Sariani Lipsky. She clipped her, she moved it back, and that was a fight. It was a special bantamweight fight, not because of Cachoeira, but it got shuffled and reshuffled because Lipsky had some issues with COVID. But the fight that I look at in this one, Matt, Cachoeira against Gina Mazzani, where Cachoeira grabbing the fence multiple times. Jason Herzog, if I'm not mistaken, was the referee in that one. Mazzani, body lock, trip takedown. Takedown number one, takedown number two. Number three was a spear. And then the fourth takedown in the second round was a single into a double in open space. And then once Mazzani got back up in that second round, she had zero gas left. And Cachoeira pushed it on her. Gets a finish, gets a great win there. But with Maverick, training with some of those folks that have trained with Mazzani in the past, Maverick, who, if she brings together the grappling, I think she can definitely get a win in this one. But Maverick, now I have question marks in every single one of her performances.
And that's the thing about Maverick. She's not going to go out there and get a ton of finishes via TKO. I know against Jojua in her early fight, she had that beautiful elbow that really caused a lot of damage to the nose. But for Maverick, it really is a case of how good can you look for those 15 minutes and really use every area of your game plan. I'm glad you bring up Priscilla's striking numbers, though, because I saw those too. I kind of don't look into them that much, and this is why. She's a massive power puncher. Power punchers more often than not aren't going to play that volume game on the outside. So for Priscilla, you will often see her kind of be down on the significant strike numbers, but still winning the battle because her strikes are that much more powerful. And that's what I really come down to in this fight. For Priscilla to have a lot of success, she's going to have to plant her own feet to land those big hooks. Every time she plants those feet to land those hooks, she's not a striker who does well at kind of getting out and getting out before she gets the receipt. She will spend that extra half second second, full second, 2 seconds in the pocket. And not that I think Miranda Maverick's going to make her pay with the strikes, but if you do find yourself a little bit stationary in some of those moments, Miranda Maverick should be able to go for takedowns. But I am glad you bring up that Gina Mazzani fight, because it shows that, hey, if Miranda Maverick is having a lot of success in that first and second round with her own offensive wrestling, but she's not doing enough to get Priscilla out of there, Cachoeira at this point has proven that she is in the top tier of power punchers. I'm not saying the rest of her game is top tier whatsoever, but she can definitely go out there and damage Miranda Maverick enough to at least make this fight close going down the stretch. And that's the weird thing that I have with this fight. Miranda Maverick could win the first two rounds, and it could still be one of those weird kind of draws at the end. Like, if she's eating a lot of damage, if she's getting hurt, not saying I think Priscilla's some cardio king, let me just get that out of the way right now in case I'm leading you guys to believe it, but I could see this as a fight where Miranda starts off looking really good. A lot of people think, hey, we're seeing that version that we once did, and then she could get into some trouble as this fight continues.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see. Maverick is a heavy favorite in the matchup, no surprise there. If we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 82.5% Maverick.
I'll say under, just for fun.
And it is under. 811 total votes, 68% Maverick, 76% by decision for the 32% that I've Cachoeira. 53% think she's going to win a decision, and 31% think that she's going to win a knockout. If Priscilla Cachoeira beats Miranda Maverick by decision, that would surprise me. And Maverick's not somebody that gets, you know, knocked down or knocked out all that often, but Cachoeira is that special breed of a flyweight that could very well get it done. Training at MMA Masters again, you know, Colby Covington out of that gym. You know, some fighters that have left that gym recently too. I do have Maverick in this one, and I think that the grappling is going to be a big deal, especially training with Robertson in Florida and training in that Kansas City area with Trey Ogden and Garrett Armfield. When's Trey Ogden at his best? When he's using his takedowns. Hasn't done it in the UFC, but that's when he's at his best. So I do like Maverick in the matchup, but this is a chintzy fight if there's ever been one.
I think she just has more tools in the toolbox. And yes, that one tool that Cachoeira has is a massive machete. And if she's able to land those strikes, we all kind of know where this fight's going to go.
Who's keeping a machete in their tool belt?
I was going more for like a Swiss Army knife versus machete, I guess. The one knife does a really good job, but it is kind of limited in the ways that you can use it. And that's how I look at Priscilla. If she's going to have success, everybody and their mom knows what she's going to do. She's going to walk forward, throw big power shots, and try to get the win that way. I just don't know if that kind of a game plan is going to be sustainable enough against Maverick, so that's why I also have Miranda.
Jacob, I need you to cut that 2x4 within 5/8 of an inch. Pull your machete out. It's time! Let's go, Matt. Both of us going with Miranda Maverick in the matchup. Some big-time fights on this card, including, hey, Derek Lewis taking on Marco Sergio de Lima. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Urosh Medic, where you been, bud? On the show for over a year, we have the return of the Dr. Urosh Medic taking on Semi the Jedi, Matthew Semelsberger. And for Medic, one lone loss in his pro career. It was in the UFC. It was to a guy who's in the top 15 at lightweight, Jalen Turner. And in that one, struggled a little bit once things get into close quarters and down to the mat. He got submitted in that matchup, but he came back like a phoenix rising his last time out. He gets outstruck in the first round by Omar Morales. Two of the three judges had that first for Morales. And then in the second round, my man's was thumping poor old one Omar Morales. He dropped him multiple times in that one. He gets the finish, and then he's on the shelf for a very long time. And Medic was matched up in a fight a little bit later on last year, but he posted a video to his Instagram. Seems like he broke his hand. He talked about bone damage, a fracture, and then ligament damage. He was getting PRP shots, and he's coming back up a weight class to 170 pounds, take on Semelsberger, which shouldn't be a surprise because for Medic, middleweight debut in Alaska, then welterweight fights, on to contender series as lightweight and beyond.
I like the move personally,
dude. Yeah, I do, because for Medic, even if you just watch his last fight against Omar Morales, they're two lightweights and Morales has kind of dabbled at 145. Medic looks way bigger than Morales in that one. So for Medic, he gets that advantage in this one. He's got the speed, he's got the power, he's got the kicks. He's a way more diverse striker than Matthew Semelsberger. But when you look at this, we've touched on it in every single Semelsberger fight. I mean, strong safety at Marist College, 200 plus pounds. And at 170 pounds, we've only really seen him struggle the Chaos Williams fight. And then, of course, his last time out, where power apparently doesn't beat control when he took on Jeremiah Wells, because he couldn't defend Jeremiah Wells' takedowns. Wells went, what, 6 of 10 on attempts? But Semelsberger dropped him in the second, dropped him in the third. The fight before that, dropped Jake Matthews every single round. So that's 5 knockdowns in his last 2 fights. And overall, just for Semelsberger, the knockdown ratio, 9-0. So he's been dropping guys consistently. And the only parts where he struggled is the little bit of pitter-patter volume against Chaos Williams and then the grappling against a guy like Jeremiah Wells. And I know I liken Semelsberger to another fighter kind of coming into the UFC, struggling with the grappling, but he's a really good striker, and if he offensively grapples, he's great. He's got a little bit of that Jack Della in him.
The thing, I think Jack Della is quite a bit better than Matthew Semelsberger, no but way. The difference is, the thing about Semelsberger that I really like is, he knows what he's good at, and he knows what he isn't good at, and I think that takes you a long way in the welterweight division. You bring up his football background, the guy is athletic AF, and you can just watch any of his fights to know that. He really does have that upper echelon physical strength and some of that fast twitch that you do look for, but the thing about Semelsberger was, I thought his offensive wrestling was going to be a bigger part of his game when he initially came into the UFC. Not that he doesn't go for offensive takedowns, but I really thought that was going to be at the forefront of his game. Box his way in, get close to his opponent, and then use some of those offensive wrestling. Where for Semelsberger, we have seen him kind of wait on the outside and try to find his big power shots. And against a guy like Medich, who is the strangest fighter, there's a scene in The Karate Kid, the one with Will Smith's son, I think his name's Jaden, where Mr. Miyagi, shout out Jackie Chan, has a boxing glove on the end of a broomstick, and he's like putting it through a sheet. And Jaden Smith's on the other side trying to move out of the way. I imagine fighting Uros Medic is like trying to fight a broomstick with a bunch of boxing gloves on it, because he is so dynamic. He is so odd to pin down. And at 170, I'm going to be really curious to see if it's going to take him a couple fights to kind of gain that physical strength of moving up in weight. Because something I was thinking about a lot this week in terms of Poirier when he fought Max Holloway. Remember when Max Holloway fought at 155 when he fought Dustin Poirier for that interim title? Yes, physically, he looked like he was a 155er. But normally it takes guys 2 or 3 fights to kind of fit into the division. I'll be curious to see if Medich is going to need sort of 2 or 3 fights to gain that physicality to fit in with the division.
Having the layoff with the hand injury,
and that's a good point,
and getting over a year, I think Medich is going to fit just fine, because again, he has all that experience at 170. But when you watch Medich on the regional scene, again, we touched on this before, it's no surprise, you watch Alaska FC fights, it's the box of chocolates analogy. It's WLF4. Some fighters are Jared Cannonier, and some fighters are just awful. Poor Victor Rodriguez,
Gina Mazzani.
So Alaska FC, a little weird. I mean, yeah, even had Terrence Mitchell the other weekend that had spent some time there. So if you look at it for Medich, I went back and watched some of those Alaska FC fights. The fight that he had, what was it, right before he fought in Contender Series, he fought Mikey Gonzalez, but with Alaska, he fought Alonzo Leisholm Jr., and in that one, grappling exchange, and to defend takedowns, what Uros Medic does, well, it's either I'm going to go for a front choke or I'm just going to punch you as many times as I can to try and deter you from getting those takedowns. So for Medich, he is a tricky sidewinder from southpaw. He will strike to all 3 levels. The other thing that you love about Medich is he can strike just as well on the back foot as he can offensively moving forward. And that's a big key against a guy like Semelsberger. You see Semelsberger just march guys down, and then he's able to have a lot of success when he's in close. You saw that against Matthews. It was a right cross was the first knockdown, and the next 2 knockdowns after that, right hook. So I'll be interested to see how Semelsberger makes out in this one, just due to the fact that A, it's a southpaw in this one against Medich, who opens up with a lot of kicks, and B, how's Medich going to make out? Because normally at lightweight, he's a bigger, taller guy. If there's a pullback and you hang out for a little bit more, that's where you get caught by a guy like Semelsberger.
I think if the fight's taking place in that position, though, Medich is going to have enough success. I think he is fast enough in that. Yes, you got to worry about the pullback, but still, he is so much faster with his hand speed in this matchup that unless he's getting his back up against the cage to where then Semelsberger can really unload on him, I do think Medich is going to have a lot of success in the open cage in a lot of these engagements. And that's why I bring up the wrestling of Semelsberger. If there's ever a time to at least threaten your wrestling to help open up your own striking game, this is the fight to do it. Because wow, if you can get Medich moving backwards, you're right. Yes, he can fight moving backwards, but it at least puts the threat of the takedown in his own mind. And he's not a bad grappler, like you said. He will go for a lot of chokes and whatnot, but he's not going to be the stronger guy than a Semelsberger. And if Matthew is able to get on top of him, I think that would be a position where he can have a lot of success. Because I think on the feet, this can be a really difficult fight to predict just because of the speed of Medich. You can see him land 4, 5, 6 strikes, but if Semelsberger is able to get on the inside, use some of those hooks. We know he's the more powerful guy that he is able to land. And then I think Semelsberger is going to land and try to go for takedowns off of some of those strikes. I don't think he's going to waste a lot of energy just trying to chase around Uros Medic around the cage.
Semelsberger did just that against a former Alaskan guy in Carlton Minus. And that was the big thing. Blending in the wrestling with the striking, he beat up on Carlton Minus. And if you want to see a guy beat up a guy in a cage where the referee just lets it happen, when Uros Medic fought Alon Cruz, why didn't Mark Smith end that one?
Alon Cruz had a ref run.
DC and Joe Rogan were pleading with Smith to end that fight, and it did not happen. You look at the matchup, Matt, Semelsberger is favored to get the win. We have a look over on Tapology for those fan votes, because honestly, I don't know where they're going to be at. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Semelsberger, because he's been the more active fighter, and at 170.
I think it'll be close to 50.
Look at that, and it is over. So 924 total votes, 75% Semelsberger, 52% by decision, 38% by knockout. For the 25% that have Medic, it's 35% by decision, 52% by knockout. So Matt, Medic out of a big-time gym, training at a King's MMA, Semelsberger out of crazy 88 Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with Coach John Del Bruge. If you're looking at this one, who's the pick?
I have a really hard time with this matchup, so because, again, last weekend we saw against Tom Aspinall and Marcin Tybura, what did I say? Speed kills at the heavyweight division especially. Tom Aspinall was so much faster than Marcin Tybura for the short amount of time that
Marcin
fight
was still bopping, it can't stop.
Yeah, he was. That was terrible. I don't know why they fed poor Marcin to another guy in his hometown. My point is, though, speed really is one of those X factors that is difficult to make up for, whether or not you have the technique or not, and that's why I bring up the speed of Uros Medic a lot. I'm still going to go with Semelsberger, because I do think he's going to be able to blend in that striking with the wrestling, but if he was just chasing Uros Medic around the cage, not able to cut him off, I think that's probably how Medic is going to win the fight.
That's the thing that scares me going back and watching the tape, because you reference the fight against Jake Matthews, and it's awesome, and it's three knockdowns, it's one per round.
Jake Matthews sometimes looks flat, though.
You watch Semelsberger, what he does is he hurts him with the pressure, and then he gets him hurt, and he either wrestles or he backs off and then lets Matthews back into the fight. So it was a little bit strange that way. I, too, am going to go with Semelsberger, but honestly, watching the tape, my mind went with Medic.
So, and I think we laid out a few good avenues for Medic to win, too. This is one of those fights where I think just stylistically, it's going to make for a very fun matchup, because if Medic is going to have success, we're going to see him try to every now and then plant his feet, land a power shot, really use some of that dynamic movement he can bring into the cage. And if Semelsberger is following him, which isn't great, we're not going to want to see that.
He will do it.
He's probably going to get hit by some big shots, but hopefully we'll be able to close the distance at some point.
It's a hard fight to predict, and people might tell you that we're silly for saying that, but you're wrong. Let us know, please. You have down in the comments section, this is a Saturday fight on Question Mark Kicks, if there ever were one. Can't wait to see these two face off on Friday. I was gonna say Saturday, but on Friday as well as on Saturday, both of us going with Semi the Jedi to get the win. Some big time fights on this card. The next one, CJ Vergaris taking on Venetia Salvador, and if you want to see flyweight finishers friggin' go at it, you're gonna want to check that one out. Keep it locked in with Fightin' Apex. We always say, let's get into it. Flyweights looking to tango this weekend in Salt Lake City with 21 finishes between them and 5 finish losses as well. We have Brazil's Venetia Salvador taking on San Antonio, Texas's CJ Vergara. And Matt, when you look forward to a fight like this, I know I got amped up, because for Venetia Salvador, going on to Contender Series, he fought a very well-established former Eternal champ in Shannon Ross. We know the Shannon Ross blueprint now. It's get finished on Contender Series, yeah. Get a contract, get finished twice in the UFC, and that is what it is. But for Salvador, he got that giant win over Shannon Ross on Contender Series, set him up well to make a big-time UFC debut. And if you watch Salvador when he fought Victor Altamirano, he kind of tried to fight a little bit like Anderson Silva, but if Anderson Silva grew his hair out, shaved it from the back up, and then just had a bump cap in the front.
Wow.
Like if you're trying to be safe, but also look cool.
Like Brazilian Ronaldo when he fought, or when he played in the World Cup.
It was the ugliest haircut I've ever seen. But Salvador, at moments, I wondered, what is this guy doing? Because at one point, he's fighting, and then all of a sudden, he backs away, walks back to the cage, goes, come on, to his opponent, and then puts his hand on his hip. Like he's just hanging out like a cool guy. And if you watch CJ Vergara in his last fight, it was a 2-round fight of the night against Daniel Lacerda da Silva, who's lost 4 fights in the UFC all by finish, but he's coming back to a screen near you in the not so distant future. And in that one, Matt, I counted, and I know this might seem wrong, but the UFC's knockdown counter is a little chintzy sometimes. Spinning wheel kick drops Vergara the first time. A straight left drops him a second time. A third time was another spinning wheel kick, and then a fourth time, I said he stumbled after a punch combo. CJ Vergara, in my opinion, got knocked down four different times in the first round of that fight. Who did it better, Vergara or Chelsea Chandler? Because Vergara was running away from the action like Anderson.
You must hate Alistair
like
Overeem.
Like Alistair Overeem or Conor McGregor, just running away from it. But in the second round, Vergara gets the action down in the mat. He's caught. It was a calf slicer, like he was taking on Brett Johns. But then Vergara landing those elbows, landing the ground and pound. Vergara, I mean, he gets into an arm triangle at one point. He looked amazing in the second round. It was a great show of determination. Coming off a tough Tatsuro Taida loss, and even the other loss that Vergara has in the UFC, I mean, if you consider it, a very, very interesting fight against Ode Osborne that was really close and showed a lot of great resolve from both athletes. So when you look at a fight like this, Matt, I mean, for Vergara, a lot of movement, a lot of side to side.
He strikes a little too much. That's all I want to say.
He does.
CJ Vergara is awesome when he's able to get guys on the ground and get that top position.
Hasn't done it a lot in the UFC.
He hasn't, but when he gets into those positions, he is very good. You bring up the ground and pound. He can threaten with submissions too, and that's where I do think the best part of his game lies. He really does make you think, okay, I have to defend this, now I have to defend strikes, and when he's able to really kind of brain scramble his opponents by just throwing a lot at them on the mat, I think he can have a lot of success. But I thought the exact same thing you did watching his last matchup. Take it to the ground, CJ, take it to the ground. And then he gets hit by big shot after big shot after big shot. And I'll be honest, before the Tatsuro Taeda matchup, I thought CJ was going to break through as a 125er at some point, just because when you do look at the totality of his skill set, there's things he can build upon. But I gotta bring it up because I said about Howie Barcelos for so many years. CJ Vergara is 32 years old. Like, at some point he is going to have to start clicking and getting his whole skill set to work together, because if he is just on the outside striking with a guy like Vinicius Salvador, especially early in the matchup, he's gonna eat a lot of power shots, and that's how you lose rounds, especially early. And that's what I have a hard time with in this fight. Can Vinicius keep that movement and keep his steadiness for at least 8-9 minutes, just so he can go out there and put it on CJ to where he's hurt enough that he's not going to be as confident going for some of those takedowns? Because you can get CJ to kind of be that outside fighter who is going to use his movement, and that's by far the worst version of him that you can possibly find. And that's why I always get kind of frustrated watching CJ Vergara fight. He's really good at the things that he can get the fight to, but then he will avoid them at some points, and it's just very frustrating to see.
And Vergara, a former Fury FC, a flyweight champ, he was able to get it done there, which is really impressive, because if you look at all the Fury champs, I mean, consider it. Joshua Van just made a debut as a super young guy, beating Jaga Shumagulov, got near the top of that peak with Fury. You also have, right now, Alberto Trujillo, who was supposed to take a fight recently, but there were some weigh-in complications. Now he's due to take on forever Fury top man at 125 that Joshua Van fought, Paris Moran. And if you think I'm not watching Trujillo Moran, you didn't think you'd hear that today. I'm damn sure going to be tuning in for that. But when you consider a fight like this, Daniel Lacerda da Silva, all he does is spinning shots. There was even a spinning elbow that landed in the second round that I'm surprised didn't drop Vergara. Vergara's got that dog in him. He's got that little pit bull in the
knee. I never thought I'd hear you say that term.
Absolutely hate it. But Salvador is one of those guys that is such a wonky striker that he just could get it done. And his last time out, the Altamirano fight, Altamirano was all over him in that one. I know 29-28, the second round was kind of close in that one. But before that, I mean, Salvador taking on some less than stellar competition in Brazil. I mean, some good fights. He fought Jafel Filho.
And he
Filho
was getting finishes, too.
Quite a while ago. But yeah, he was getting finishes. He was, what, 12-4 at a time coming into Contender Series off a win over a debuting fighter. So if you do look at the odds in this one, they are skewed towards CJ Vergara. He is favored, the American, in this one. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. I think they're going to be fairly close. I'm going to say over under 60% Vergara.
I like where you set them. I'm not going to lie. I'll say under.
You're saying under. It's over 1,058 votes. The fans like this one. 78% Vergara, 78% by decision. For the 22% that have Salvador, 48% by decision, 39% by knockout. Matt, these guys are flyweights. They have 25 wins between them, 21 of them by finish, and 5 finish losses between them. The fans anticipate a decision between flyweight finishers.
And I can't disagree with the fans if you want my honest opinion, and this is why. I think both guys are so well matched, it's going to be really difficult for one to pull out ahead and get that finish win. Unless CJ just gets hurt really early in this matchup and can't find his way to fight himself back in, I think it's a really close matchup, and I think that's why the fans have it so close and going to a decision. ever so slightly, I am going to pick CJ Vergara in this matchup. I know I spent most of this video just saying all the things I wish he did more of, but again, that fighter is in there somewheres. Whether or not we're going to see it Saturday, that's a completely different discussion, but I have seen it on the regional scene, and I think he will get back to that.
I mean, to me, the struggle that I have is Vergara struggled against Ody Osborne in the striking, against Cletison Rodriguez so in the striking, against Daniel Da Silva in the striking. I'll go with Vinicius Salvador, and I didn't even think this guy would ever win a fight in the UFC. So, Matt, this is a little bit of a wonky one. I'm going Salvador. You're going with Vergara. I love myself a CJ Vergara fight, and in turn, I like a Salvador fight as well. Make sure you're tuning in for the rest of the videos in the series. The next one coming up, Jake Matthews taking on Darius Flowers. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. And it's finally time for the UFC debut of one of the biggest winners from Dana White's Contender Series last summer. Beast Mode, not Marshawn Lynch, it's Darius Flowers set to take on Jake Matthews, the Celtic Kid, on 10 days' notice. Flowers coming into this one replacing Caramel Thunder Miguel Baeza. And if you look at it for a guy like Darius Flowers, he came on to Contender Series last week. It was week 5. Headlined by Mick Parkin. Man, that guy's pretty darn good. You also had Jesus Aguilar on that episode. He's already got a lot of fights under his belt in the UFC. D. Gomes as well. A lot of big-time fighters. And so for Darius Flowers, he was going to take on the Octagon Man, Amiran Gogoladze. That was an odd episode of our Contender Series breakdowns because I was stricken with the vid. And in that one, Darius Flowers came into the chat. I somehow got unprofessional. I went with Amiran Gogoladze, and I reached out on Instagram to apologize to Darius Flowers, who's all about it and a very nice gentleman. So it's great to see him finally make that debut because he tested positive for Ostarin with the Nevada State Athletic Commission. It was those trace amounts, the pulsing, if you will. So he and at the same time Kyler Phillips popped for that. Now Flowers gets this shot, and it's really going to be interesting because Flowers, for what it's worth, from his amateur days where he was 11-5-1 to his pro career, 12-5-1, he's bounced around weight classes like there's no tomorrow. He's fought as high as 200 pounds. He's fought as low as 170 pounds. He was supposed to make a debut at 155 pounds against Eric Gonzalez before that fight was scratched due to that struggle with the athletic commission. So for Flowers, it'll be interesting in this one, fighting at welterweight, getting that shot at 170, seeing how that weight cut affects him. Because if you look at him in the last year, what's he been up to? I think he's trained at every single gym known to man.
Round.
And I'll show. I started off, I was like, I'm going to set pins on a Google map, and then I'm just going to go from there. And then he on his Instagram page just posted every single gym. So I didn't have to look through individual photos and do it. But when you consider for a guy like Darius Flowers, I mean, I think the most interesting part about him is the best part of his game is his wrestling, and he really does butter his bread with that. The Gogoladze fight was weird because Gogoladze was going for an inverted triangle. Flowers has that kind of Jared Brooks, Shorty Torres, just get up. He then kind of has the slam drop down, and Gogoladze from bottom, he hurts his shoulder. That's the end of the fight. So an awesome win for Flowers, who really amped up Dana White before that one to get out and see that fight. For Flowers, though, 1-10 in a boxing record. He also had a win that was overturned to a no contest in New York against a 41-year-old where he dropped him twice, which is a fun fight to watch on the rewatch. But 7 knockout losses there. He's got plenty of knockout wins as a pro in MMA as well. He's got a lot of really good experience. He was 4-0 in 2020, and now he gets the opportunity against the guy who came in as 19-year-old on Tough Nations, and I'll throw the picture up there, when he took on Olivier Aubert-Mercier, Jake Matthews, who can offensively wrestle sometimes, but defensively struggles with wrestling.
Jake Matthews is like a used car you're trying to get rid of, and you really hope that the people don't look and see that it's full of body filler. Because for Jake Matthews, I've described Jake Matthews to my friends before and why they should watch him fight. He's really, like, most of his fights are really entertaining, right? He's gonna go in there and box with you. He does have heavy hands, but he can land them. He can get taken down, but he's a good grappler, right? He can get submission wins. He has some submission losses. The problem is, he never shows up the version of him that I think we're going to get. And that's the really hard part for me trying to predict this fight, because Jake Matthews is 155 pounds. I thought was a really good fighter, actually, and I thought that was the weight class where he was really going to grow into and become one of those top tier fighters. But he made the transition to 170, and I don't think it's a bad transition. Like, he's a big guy for the weight class but it took him a little while to become the physical guy that he is right now.
Yeah, and I mean, Matthews, you know, physical maturity, and you get into he's only 28. He's, what, 11-6 in the UFC. But if you look at it for Matthews, he looked big against Fialho and Semelsberg in his last couple
100%,
fights.
But that's my big thing with Jake Matthews. Like, it's just so complicated, and that's why I'm having a hard time articulating it, because Matthews is a very good offensive striker. When he's able to work the jab, when he's able to go to the body with his combinations, he can have a lot of success. But we have seen fights, even go back to the Rocco Martin fight. You probably didn't think that was the name you were going to hear today. Jake Matthews is having a lot of success, gets hit by one shot, gets in one grappling situation, and immediately submits. Like, for Matthews, he will look good, and then he can get caught in odd positions, which is weird, because for Matthews, those were the things he excelled in for so long.
The Li Jingliang fight, there's some grappling sequences in that fight. The Oliviero Bam Mercier fight, the reason he lost is because he got out-wrestled for the large majority of it. The coaches were yelling at him to strike. I mean, Pat Cote and Kyle Noak, big-time coaches
on that
one.
But that's always been my thing with Jake Matthews. He will strike and look really good, and then he'll get hit by, not a glancing blow, I don't want to under-characterize what these shots are, but he'll get hit by shots sometimes that do wobble him, and then he fights like a different version of himself. And I don't know if Darius Flowers is going to be the guy who goes in there and rocks him enough to force that version of him, but we have seen Jake Matthews get hit and then become a much different version of himself.
And in terms of all of those gyms that Flowers has been with, whether it was Syndicate, whether he's trained a little bit at, you know, some of the gyms in the surrounding areas in Iowa, he's also gone down to other spots in Vegas, he's gone down to California, he's gone down to Miami as well. For Flowers, though, the big-time base Chicago fight team, and you've seen him be a main sparring partner with Bilal Muhammad there, and Muhammad has sung his praises for a really long time. That guy's a respected voice in MMA.
And what a great guy to train with.
Yeah, when it comes to Flowers, that's a great compliment to his game, because the boxing's a little bit secondary to the grappling, which could carry him to a win against a guy like Matthews in this one. For Matthews, the long history, the 17 fights in the UFC, he's got a 5-4 knockdown ratio. And I know knockdown ratios for me today are going to be a big part of it. I wrote them down for a lot of these fighters, but he's clipped. And he's also been clipped. He's had good offensive wrestling.
I feel like the Fialho fight was like 6 of his actual knockdowns.
Yeah, that was kind of crazy. And if you do look at it for Matthews, I mean, training out of Australia for this one, be interesting to see how both these guys make out at elevation as well.
The last thing I want to say, though, is Jake Matthews is a good example of, you can't just look at a guy's age and kind of assume everything from that. You bring it up. He's been around in the UFC for 9 years now. It's like Jason Tatum. Bill Simmons wants Jason Tatum to still be 19 years old. The guy's 26. He's in his prime. So for Matthews, you might look at 28 and still think there's a lot of tread left on the tires, and there very well may be, but he has been in some difficult fights like you bring up, and he has eaten some damage at only 28. Robert Whitaker's the other example I was going to bring up. Whitaker's, what, 32 years old? Like, you don't look at 32 and think, wow, he's really old.
Yeah, Jose Aldo was almost out exactly. of it at 33.
But when you think about it, Aldo, Whitaker, these are guys who are fighting for titles in their early 20s, and they've just been able to maintain their spots in the division for so long. Matthews is kind of like that, but from, like, the 16 to 10 spot in the welterweight division.
Yeah, he's like Nathaniel Wood, and you even saw him get dropped on the weekend, even though he beat a big-time
what a
guy
fight that was.
In Andre Feely. But for Jake Matthews, I mean, fight of the nights with Li Jingliang, Johnny Case, and then a performance bonus over Andrea Fialho. We'll see how this one shakes out. Again, on really short notice, is it for Darius Flowers coming in on 10 days notice? We have a look at the Tapology vote, Matt. Surprise us that it is to you. It was a struggle. I think the fans, they like Jake Matthews. He's been around for a really long time. I'm going to say over under 80% Matthews.
I think it'll be over.
And it is over. So short sample size, 562 total votes, 90% Matthews, 10% going with Darius Flowers. Again, Flowers has good boxing. Flowers has good wrestling. Flowers gets backed up sometimes, and I don't necessarily love that. Jake Matthews is kind of a low-volume striker. 3.09 to 2.44 is the strikes, significant strikes landed to what he absorbs per minute. Those are low in both categories. So this could be a large feeling out process, or Darius Flowers goes out there, rinse and repeats takedowns, gets a ground and pound finish.
I think that's going to be a really difficult thing to do against a guy like Matthews, because Matthews, he can get held down, but he will go for initial submissions, especially out the gate, and that does help him work his way back up to the feet. I'm going to have Matthews ever so slightly, because I do think the variety of shots he can throw on the feet is going to be effective, but Matthews is one of these guys who, when it's all offense, he is fine. But when he's the one being backed up, when he's the one who's forced to make those decisions at the ball or on the balls of his feet, that's when he can fall into trouble. So if Flowers can really back him up and use his physicality, maybe he can have a lot of success, but I think Matthews still has a little bit left in the tank.
And we've seen the Ersegs of the world, the Basil Hafezes of the world, the Naimovs of the world come in, make giant impacts on short notice against ranked and unranked competition recently. I will go with Jake Matthews in the matchup, but there is no slight on Darius Flowers. This guy can definitely get it done in a matchup like this. We will see how it turns out, both of us with the Celtic kid in the fight. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big-time fights, including Roman Kapilov and one Claudio Ribeiro. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. With a combined 21 wins and 20 of them by knockout, we have two big swinging middleweights going at it this weekend. And Roman Kapilov, the former AMC Fight Nights Global middleweight champion, is taking on Brazil's Claudio Ribeiro of Watch Out for That Left Hook fame. And if you look at it for Claudio Ribeiro, I'm going to reference that one to the end of time. He's taking on Ivan Valenzuela. And if you look at it, Sean Strickland's just yelling, watch out for that big left hook. And then it lands. And you have Ribeiro getting the win there on Contender Series. Takes a debut against Abdulrazak Alhassan, a well-established vet at both welterweight and at middleweight. And in that one, Claudio looked really good in the first round. He won that first round. And then in the second, it was just the pressure, the big-time right hand of Abdulrazak Alhassan. Three big shots, it's over. So for Ribeiro, his last time out, he takes on Joseph Holmes. He goes out there, gets the win in the second round. It is all over, folks. And for Ribeiro, a lot of early finishes. And I know that win over Kellis Albuquerque that he had before he fought on Contender Series, that was a little bit later on in the fight. But if you watch Ribeiro fights, the capoeira, the dancing, he has a boxing background. If you watch him fight, though, it's really strange because for a guy that has really big action kicks and really big looping hooks, the thing that you're going to forget about that doesn't show numbers on a page, if you watch him, he fights a lot like, and I hate to say it, Haley Cowan. He likes to dig underhooks and put his opponent up against the cage, do absolutely nothing with clinch positions until he strikes again.
Is Claudio to you, because this is what he is to me, he reminds me a little bit of a Chad Mendes. Everything he does really well makes him tired. And that's what I worry about, because when Claudio is the one who's throwing those big shots, not in the way that they fight at all, but just in the terms of when Chad would go for a lot of wrestling, what would it do? It would make him tired and it would hurt his striking as the fight continued.
That's why he's so good at bare knuckle boxing, right?
I'm never going to say a bad thing. Chad Mendes is one of my favorite fighters to watch of all time, and I'm not exaggerating. I loved watching Chad Mendes fight. Watch the Jose Aldo matchups. But for Claudio, when he is throwing those big actions, when he is putting a lot into his shots, be it the kicks or the hands, he is going to become a lesser version of himself as a result. And I do think the Abdulrazak Alhassan fight is a bit of a microcosm for how you can fight a guy like Claudio. Yes, you might lose the battle early, but if you're steady enough to just keep volume in his face, I do think it's going to make it a lot harder for him to really set up some of those bigger shots, because for as good of a boxer as Claudio is, he's not going to go in there like a Calvin Kattar and really work that jab to the body, go to the body with a lot of hooks. He is going to throw a lot more of those bigger shots. And for Roman Kapilov, I've had the worst read on this man possible. I didn't think he was going to be great coming into the UFC, and after his first two fights, I'm just being honest, I didn't know what his overall ceiling was coming into the UFC, and he didn't look great out the gate. Let's just call it what it is. The man has completely changed my mind on him in his last two matches,
and that's it. Like, for Roman Kapilov, the time in the UFC, it's been very sporadic. And recently he's been active. He's kind of found his mojo again. Coming into the UFC, I thought Roman Kapilov was going to be all that and a bag of potato chips. And then you look at the two losses. He drops Albert Duraev. He puffs up that left eye, as we showed a couple weeks ago. He gets submitted by alleged bad guy, Kyle Roberson. But then his last two times out, I mean, he gets the win over Alessio Di Chirico. He retires Manzo. And then his last time out, he beats Puna Soriano and looks amazing in that matchup. So for Kapilov, the basis, it's combat sambo. He was a champ. He was a champ at hand-to-hand combat as well. He is not good with takedowns. And for some reason, people think combat sambo, it's a lot of takedowns. For combat sambo, if you just want to watch
two kinds,
combat sambo striking, look at Azamat Mirzakhanov. Watch him when he takes on Iwan Kutsalaba in combat sambo. It's a lot of strikes, a lot of combinations. Kapilov has great boxing, not the greatest takedown defense, and not the greatest offensive takedowns. And for Kapilov, it's a lot of big right hand, but boxing combination, shelling up defensively, and that's what you like to see out of him, and that's what you've seen out of his last two fights, to the tune of the fact that he even took down the, what was it, D2, D3, Wartburg man himself, Puna Soriano. So Kapilov has been bringing it together recently, training at home, Ratty team, Universal Fighters, and if you look at it for Ribeiro, coming out of that Equipe Herrera Black Gym. So interesting there for Ribeiro. But I look at a fight like this, again, Is it the straight, concise, technical shots of Kapilov, or is it the big actions and the power of a guy like Claudio Ribeiro?
I think you answered your own question, I think. Is it the straight, technical shots or the wild ones, Craig? I'm going to go with the straight, technical ones almost every single time.
All right, well, Kapilov is heavily favored to get the win in this matchup. Go ahead.
If I may, though, I do think that Puna Soriano fight was one that is going to change the mind of the average MMA fan, because Puna's a difficult guy to get down right. He's got big power. You can't just march him down and have a lot of success, but beating a guy like Puna, I think you can follow a similar game plan against Claudio, even though I think Puna's higher up in the division personally.
Yeah, if you do, again, 20 of 21 wins between these two guys are by knockout. They're by Roman Kapilov, one by decision, Claudio, all 11 by knockout. We have a look at those topology votes. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 77.5% Kapilov.
I think it'll be a big favorite, personally. I think it'll be over.
And it is over. 1,055 total votes, 89% Kapilov, 73% by knockout for the 11% that have Ribeiro. What is that? 66% by knockout.
That's fair.
Taking a guy who's never won a decision, possibly to win by decision, but 66% by knockout. I think Kapilov gets the win in this one. I think he just keeps it high and tight. He marches things down. But Claudio Ribeiro could probably knock out a horse on any given day.
That's why I have a weird time with this fight, because you look at this fight and think automatic excitement, right? Like, both guys are going to go in there, throw big, heavy shots. I think we are going to get a bit of a tentative period, especially early on, for Claudio, because he does use his movement quite well. So I think it's going to be difficult for Roman to really get him down, get him up against the cage, and start initiating some of those boxing combinations. So I think we might get a bit of a feeling out process, but I agree with you. I think as the fight continues, I like the straight shots of Kapilov, and I think he does much better at throwing in combination.
Vinicius Salvador in this card is like a flyweight Alex Oliveira. He's just fighting with every organization that'll have him. Claudio Ribeiro is a little bit like that at 185 pounds. Both of us in this one going with Kapilov to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this matchup. The next fight on the docket, Trevin Giles taking on Gabriel Bonfim. You are not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Heavyweights battling out in style. Coming up this weekend from Salt Lake City, we have Derek Lewis, the Black Beast, looking to capitalize on his first win since he bounced back off the interim title shot at UFC 265 in beating Chris Daukaus in a main event. That was back in 2021. Lewis this weekend taking on a surging Pesão, Marcos Rogério de Lima, who today I decided, you know what? I'm going to seek out some of that weird Pesão tape. Because listen, this was a guy that we know. He's the Priscilla Catchweight of light heavyweight. Really struggled at making 205, so he had to bounce up to 265, only to become one thick, juicy boy at heavyweight. And again, I know that Rogério de Lima's on a run. But go back to a time when Rogério de Lima was 7-0, fighting 21-1 Paulo Filho. You can find that clip on YouTube. It's terrible. But you see a lot of ground and pound from Rogério de Lima. You see a lot of celebrating and so on and so forth. But when you look at a fight like this, for Derek Lewis, he's lost in consecutive fights. He got finished by Tai Tuivasa, Sergey Spivak, and Sergey Pavlovich. Now, that'll happen. Those guys are all ranked in the top of this division. But if you look at it for Lewis, 10 UFC main events, 5 co-main event slots. This guy has had 15 big spots in 26 UFC fights. This is the 5th, and he's only fought on 5 prelim fights so far in his UFC career. This is his first prelim spot since 2016, when Derek Lewis beat Damian Grabowski by TKO in the first round. It does not happen very often.
Is Derek Lewis like Cincinnati Reds Ken Griffey Jr.?
He's
Is
a little
that no
bit King like,
Cop? Because for Lewis, you're right. Like, in his prime, he was not only one of the better heavyweights, but one of the most famous, too. And we're going to talk about that a lot more in the main event, because, you know, the lightweight division is not only a division with a lot of good fighters, it has a lot of big star names as well. And for Derek Lewis, he did a great job marketing himself outside the cage, which not enough people do whatsoever.
Hasn't had an Instagram in, like, a year now.
Which is wild, because that was the thing that really got people on board with Derek Lewis. They saw that side of him, they saw the humor, and they thought, okay, not only can he knock people dead, he's kind of a funny guy outside of the cage.
But for Lewis, he can cut weight. Guys, can he ever cut weight?
The thing about Derek Lewis, though, it's really interesting, because his whole life he has fought like you think a heavyweight fights. It's, hey, I'm going to just get up when I get taken down, even though he doesn't use a lot of technique. And all you guys know what I mean when I say Derek Lewis just gets up. You can have his back with both hooks in sometimes, and Derek Lewis decides, nah, I'm done with this. Gets back up to his feet, does everything wrong, but somehow has the physical strength to get out of those sticky situations, and then he can find success in the feet. The fight that I watched a couple of times in preparation reason for this was the Marcin Tybura fight, oddly enough. And you want to know why?
Because he finishes him early?
No, he finishes him late after he gets beat in the first two rounds. But for Lewis, he doesn't do a good job accepting pressure. And I do think with Lewis and his game plan, it really comes down to being one note. When he's moving forward, when he is the hammer, let's just be honest, there's not a lot of heavyweights that can withstand Derek Lewis. If he hits you with big power shots, the fight's pretty much over. Tai Tuivasa was able to eat a couple of them, but for the most part, Lewis has been able to just maintain that power. The question that I have is, at 38, are we starting to see that decline? And not even at 38, has the decline already begun? And are we starting to ask ourselves, how much does Derek Lewis have left? Because if Lewis was that top 10, top 5 version of himself, I genuinely don't think this fight is very close. I think he can close the distance very rapidly. We all know the odd athleticism Derek Lewis has. He looks like a big guy, but he can close that distance very fast. And against a guy like De Lima, who's known for throwing those big wide shots, he's got the great leg kick as well. I just don't know if De Lima's speed can match Derek Lewis. I know that's a wild thing to say because you bring it up. De Lima's a former 205er. He fought at 210 like 3 times, so I always want to call him a 210er. But for De Lima, I still don't think speed is something that followed him up into the heavyweight division. I always assume when someone goes from 205 to heavyweight, they're going to have that big speed advantage like we have seen some guys. On. But De Lima bulking up hasn't been a recipient of that.
How many times do you think in the crowd last week, UFC London, you got Aspinall taking on Tybura, how many times do you think some British guy said, I'm going to butcher it, but said, that's a 210er, isn't it? They're just offering up money.
Hopefully not. But you get my point. Yeah, DeLima's not a guy who moved from 205 to heavyweight and then just became this crazy good athlete. Like, if you fought Jaltan Almeida, you would really see a big difference in their levels of athleticism. No, but DeLima's done a really good job at becoming more of himself when he moved up in weight, because that would just accentuate his power.
And you knew DeLima as a kickboxing champ coming into MMA. He was not just a Sao Paulo, but a Brazilian, but a South American, but a Panamanian. Or Pan-American, not Panamanian. He didn't go to Panama for it. Maybe he did, but a Pan-American champ. All that in kickboxing. You see that with Rogério de Lima. Now, the thing that scares me is Rogério's fought all different shapes and sizes of men, Stefan and he's Struve. Won the majority of these fights. Stefan Struve was a co-main event to a Jan Blachowicz card where he got submitted by Stefan Struve. And Derek Lewis, you talk about it, the just comeback fights against Tybura, against Volkov, he's able to get it done. You look at Rogério de Lima, and I went back and I watched this fight against a fellow thicker boy, Alexander Romanov. What happens in that one? Forearm choke, and that's a submission, and you rarely see that.
So meathead.
But if you watch it, until Romanov gets the takedown, Rogério, hands down by his waist, landing those leg kicks, and that's a big thing for De Lima. He lands those leg kicks, and you have to either switch stance or back off, and then the boxing opens up for De Lima. You look at the fight that De Lima had against Ben Rothwell. March forward, bull rush him, I think is the proper way to say that. And Rogério de Lima gets the win in that one. For de Lima, 6-5 from 2014 until the end of 2020. But from 2021 on, he's 4-1 with that only loss going to Alexander Romanov. And you look at his last time out, it was the worst fight against Blagoy Ivanov. Happy trails, sweet prince. Rogério somehow wins that one. People were split on the MMA decisions on that one. But it was a close fight. There were 6 that had it for De Lima, 7 that had it for Ivanov. But if you go and you look at this one, De Lima training with those big guys at American Top Team. A lot of big heavyweights there. I'm sure Marcelo Gomes got a few rounds in that one. For Derek Lewis, I assume he's still training in Houston. 4-ounce Fight Club, Main Street Boxing and Muay Thai. Crew Bob Perez there. But if you're looking for Lewis, no social medias, no Instagrams anymore. He broke the mold there. So if you do look at a fight like this, De Lima is slightly favored in the fight. I'd say it's probably going to be pick 'em by the end of it. So we have a look at Tapology to see what the fans are thinking this
one. How are these men the same age? That's what I, like, to me, De Lima's been 38 for 38 years. And Derek Lewis, we have kind of seen the natural progression of his career. I gotta be like, De Lima, I thought was old when he fought at 205. That's all. It's just surprising for me to see these guys kind of meet in the middle, because De Lima was on the outside of that top 15 for so long. And when he was fighting those upper echelon guys, I thought Struve was going to be the win that really catapulted him, at least into fighting more consistent top 15 opposition. And he did drop him early in the fight. But we saw when De Lima is forced on his back to really grapple for elongated positions, he does struggle quite heavily. Not saying we're going to see that a lot in the Derek Lewis matchup, but we have seen Derek Lewis shoot for double legs in the past. He doesn't get a lot of them, but he does shoot for that technique, and I'll be curious to see if we do see some wrestling out of Lewis in this matchup.
And you'll see low hands, head kick. Will it be there for Lewis? The fan vote. Surprise us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 65% for Pizarro de Lima in this one.
I think it'll be under because Derek Lewis is such a big fan favorite.
And it is the opposite. You're right. 1,208 total votes. 60% Lewis, 91% by knockout for the 40% that have Rogério de Lima, 58% by knockout, and there's 21% by submission. I'm going Rogério de Lima in the matchup. I wasn't sold when he fought Ben Rothwell going into the fight that, listen, that he would do something like that. Sure enough, he did. The first knockout loss that Rothwell had since Cain Velasquez. But if you look at it for Rogério de Lima, combination of hand speed, the fact that if he does march forward, if he does throw the leg kicks, he can have a lot of success. I think his last fight, a little bit of an anomaly because it was just the slowing down of the watch against Blagoy Ivanov. But I do have Rogério de Lima in the matchup.
I have Derek Lewis, and I'm going to bring up a point I'll bring up in a little bit. I don't think Rogério de Lima would have beat any of the guys Derek Lewis lost to, because all those guys are genuinely quite talented fighters at this point.
You have so the one guy, the number six guy, and the number eight guy. Those are all the guys that Lewis lost to.
Derek Lewis has only gotten ready to fight guys in the top 15 for six straight years. Every time Derek Lewis fights somebody, they're arguably the best heavyweight in the division, and I do think that helps you over time. Now, if Lewis is a shell of himself, if he just doesn't have much left, if this is kind of a swan song, if you will, then yes, I could see de Lima landing a lot of those leg kicks, making Derek Lewis fight in more of a defensive manner, because when Lewis is backed up, he is not nearly the guy he is when he's moving forward. Even go back to the Travis Brown fight, you can see that. But I still think Lewis is going to be able to counter off of one of those leg kicks and land a big shot.
We'll see how this one goes. Split on the pick. I'm going with Brazil's de Lima. Matt going with the Black Bees, Derek Lewis. Some big time fights on this card. Chiesa is taking on Holland. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Welterweight set to bang in Salt Lake City. I bet some of the folks there won't like what I just said, but it is what it is. We have the problem. Trevin Giles taking on Maritinha Gabriel Bonfim, the undefeated Bonfim, the good Bonfim, the best Bonfim.
I think they're both pretty good, though.
Gabriel Bonfim, the only one that's undefeated at this point, especially in the UFC. He came in with a lot of fanfare. He beat Trey Waters on Contender Series, and that's a win that holds a lot of weight because Waters ended up coming into the UFC afterwards and beating Josh Quinlan. So for Bonfim, he gets that win. Von Flew caught in the guillotine, then he gets it into that Von Prue position, and his last time out against Munir Lazez, he just threw caution to the wind, walked him down, marched him forward. He ended up getting the big time win there against Lazez, and we touched a lot on Bonfim coming into the UFC. Let's throw it on over to a clip about Gabriel Bonfim. For Gabriel Bonfim, what got him to the dance, it's definitely his boxing, and his brother has a boxing record, and so does Gabriel. But for Gabriel, he was a Brazilian super welterweight champion. And that does,
Craig,
that does kind of account for something. And he was able to get a 5-0 record there. But if you do consider for a guy like Gabriel Bonfim, boxing from the outside, he is very well-rounded as well. An undefeated, squeaky clean record. He also happens to be an LFA welterweight champ. Now, LFA's kind of given that welterweight rub to some guys that you might go, Nakon Mendonça? Like the guy that's over with Bellator? Huh? Or Carlos Leal that ended up over with the PFL. But for Bonfim, he was able to get that before he went on Contender Series last year. Derek Krantz also happened to be a welterweight champ over with the LFA, and it didn't work out in the UFC. But for Gabriel Bonfim, Matt, I know we're both excited about him.
Yeah.
But I don't want to just prop up Bonfim too much to take away the shine from Lazez, because both these guys on the outside are very, very accomplished strikers in MMA.
If Bonfim can throw in combination, and that's really going to be the key too, I think he's going to have to really mix in his combinations, because if you go single shot for a single shot, Munir Lazez is a big guy for this division. I know they're both listed at 6'1", but Lazez has a very big frame and he has big legs too. And I know he was on the receiving end of some kicks against Alves, but I do think that at that range, he can have some success with some of his longer range strikes. But if Bonfim backs him up between those two black lines, which is a position that a lot of guys do struggle with, like, okay, Dustin Poirier can fight behind there, Conor McGregor could in his prime, but there's a handful of fighters that can really excel on the back foot. I think Bonfim can have a lot of success if he can push Lazez back, but that's going to be the really interesting thing, because if he can't throw in combination to get Lazez's respect, it's going to be really difficult for him to push Lazez back.
And it's kind of tough, because with both of these guys, I think striking defense-wise for a couple of guys that are primary strikers, Munir Lazez actually does a better job at open distance. Gabriel Bonfim, for what it's worth, holds his hands really wide apart, like it's a boxing stance without the gloves, and he gets hit down the middle. If you go back and watch his last fight on Contender Series, he was on the same card as his brother, and he took on Trey Waters. Trey Waters came in on really short notice for one of the best names in MMA, Felix Klinkhammer. And in that fight, Trey Waters was landing the jab on the outside. Now, Bonfim was touching him up, had his right eye swelled up. ran in for a double leg, got caught in the guillotine, and out of that, used the shoulder pressure to get a Von Prue choke. And we're going to talk a lot about Vince St. Preux on this card because Shogun is on this card.
Well, that time a skateboard got thrown into the cage?
That was wild. But if you do look at it for Gabriel Bonfim, and I go through all of the fights that he had, the one that he had at LFA 126, his opponent weighed 175.8, so he couldn't win the title. He looked really good in that one. He looked great before that with the LFA. And I'll show you, like, in his fights, he's not just taking on striker, grappler. Like, the fight that he had at LFA 112, it was against a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And I'll put it up on the screen, the combo he was able to land in the second round. This guy goes body head, and he has such speed and power in these combinations that he kind of catches his opponents off guard. So Gabriel Bonfim, the boxing record. The jiu-jitsu, though, is at the forefront. Yeah. Boxing to get it down to the mat, to get it into submission abilities. You look at it for Trevin Giles. Coming into the UFC, this guy was awesome. He had beaten Brennan Allen. He had beaten Ryan Spann. He had also beaten Ike Villanueva. Finished Allen and finished Villanueva. Beat Ryan Spann by split decision. He comes in, finish win after finish win to kick it off. And it went from 185 to now down at 170. And if you look at his last four fights, Streakus du Plessis, he also had the fight against Michael Morales. He fought against Luis Cosi. And Giles last time out against Preston Parsons. It's been really interesting because he was having a lot of success against Streakus du Plessis until he got finished. He was having a lot of success against Michael Morales until he got finished. And his last two against Cosi, who... Yeah,
that's the thing. Trevin Giles was fighting guys who were much higher than the last two opponents, I would say.
But when he took on Preston Parsons, that's a split decision win where I thought Parsons won a couple of rounds in that one. Regardless, it was a close fight. Most people thought it was a close fight, and you'll get chatter from both sides. But for Giles, what he struggled against is if you can really grapple against him, and not many have in the UFC, but if you can really, really get him down and tangle with him, you can really cause him some issues on the mat. And Parsons is able to threaten with a lot of that. Giles has really good submission defense, and that's one of the things that you like to see. He's got that powerful pressure jab. You saw that when he took on, I mean, Roman Dolidze. It was great. But for Giles, it's just piecing every bit of his game together when you're taking on some
And that's the Trevin Giles is a good case study on when being well-rounded sometimes becomes a bit of a detriment. Because Trevin Giles can do pretty much everything in MMA, right? Like, he's a good striker, he can wrestle, he has submissions. Like, he can do everything. But it has been a case of, like, we said about Gilbert Burns for how many years. It was, hey, when Gilbert can match the striking with the wrestling and the jiu-jitsu, that's a real dangerous mixed martial artist. And for Giles, when he's the one aggressive, when he's moving forward, really making you feel his physicality with the jab, with the boxing combinations, he has great hand speed, and that was something that did follow him down from 185 to 170. I was a little bit concerned that we were going to lose some of the things that made him special up a weight class, because he was a little bit undersized, right? But I think he made it work well for him. He was using the jab, and I understand he lost to Dricus, who was at the top of the division, Morales, who can look really good and then sometimes bad in the same fight even when he wins. So for Giles, it always has been a case of, can he just stick to the things that he does well? I brought it up with Matthew Semelsberger to open this card. The thing I like about Semelsberger is he knows what he does well, he knows what he doesn't do well, he's going to try to avoid the parts of the game that he can't do, and he's going to try to accentuate the things he can do really well. Giles, the weird thing about his grappling is he can get held in positions, and that's what I'm not a big fan of. Even if he can defend that initial takedown attempt, he sometimes can sprawl. Go back to the James Krause fight. James Krause is able to hold him in a lot of different positions.
You mean
The James Krause, not a name we bring up a lot, but he was really able to have success controlling Giles in the mat. And you bring up the submission defense. It is a very important part of his game, but he can still lose minutes and rounds in some of those positions. And that's why I think Bonfim can have success, because you bring up the submission ability. If he gets on top of Giles, I don't think it will be a case of kind of that one hit, one kill, right? Giles is very squirmy on the ground. He moves very well off his back, but Bonfim can use that time to at least control Giles and win moments and win rounds that
and
way.
And we talk about fights like this all the time. So there's one example that pops into my head. The fight that Terrence McKinney had against Sean Woodson over on Dana White's Contender Series. McKinney's winning that fight, and it's down on the mat, and he goes to stand up after Woodson's already popped back up. He eats a knee for his troubles. He gets finished. You look at Trevin Giles' fight against Zach Cummings. Winning the fight. In the third round, gets in at an odd angle, gets caught in a guillotine. That's the end of the fight, and you have a win for Zach Cummings. So 73% takedown defense in the UFC for Trevin Giles, but he's been taken down by Neto BJJ. No, it's Antonio Braga Neto. Where's he been? I don't know. Missing him for all these years. Mearshart, Krause, Dolidze, du Plessis, and Cosi, and a fight of the night against Krause, as you had mentioned. But Preston Parsons had some takedown success as well. So as good as the takedown defense is for Trevin Giles, he does get taken down a little bit. For Bonfim, good takedowns, good boxing, but the thing that I mentioned in that clip is with Bonfim, his striking defense is choppy. He got hit quite a bit by Lazzez on his way in for his troubles to get the fight down to the mat, and you saw it. He pulls guillotine, and then he rolls it, and he's on top, and he gets a submission win. But Bonfim holds his hands really wide, and Trevin Giles does strike.
Backs up a lot.
Although it is at low volume, Giles throws a lot of jab, 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 right cross down the middle to where Bonfim keeps his hands wide open, and that could pose a big problem for Bonfim against a guy like Giles in MMA.
You are right, but I think if Bonfim sees the same technique over and over again, it's just going to allow him to start calculating some of his own counters, because if he is able to start slipping the jab of Trevin Giles, you bring it up, Giles is going to pump that jab in your face, but there's not always the right hand coming behind it. And if Bonfim can start to decipher, okay, if I slip this shot and crack it with my own power shot, I just don't know if Giles at 170 is going to have that level of durability. Now, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm not right just because I say it.
The Morales fight.
But Trevin Giles is, like, he's a big guy. He's fought at 205. He's fought at 185. He is a big guy for this weight class, and I'm always worried when he cuts down to 170. I truly am. Maybe I'm the only person, because he is fighting in his weight class. You can tell that he looks like a big fighter, and he wasn't looking that same way at 185, but those 15 pounds are a very big drop to make. So maybe he pulls a Paul Craig and makes me look absolutely foolish, but I do think it is a good point to bring up.
Some big time fights on this one, and Bonfim in the fight is a pretty big favorite. We have a look over on Topology. Surprise us there to you. I think they're going to be close-ish.
I think this is a fight of the night. I'm going to say that right now, and this is why. If Bonfim wins, especially by spectacular fashion, I bring up the jab and the counter abilities on purpose. I think Giles is going to be the aggressive party, at least early in this matchup, until Bonfim hits him with a shot that makes him not. That's my prediction.
So I'm going to say over under 70% Bonfim here.
I think it'll be over, even though personally I have that bar lower.
Holy smokes. I didn't think it was going to be. 1,139 total votes, 94% Bonfim, 67% by submission, 17% by knockout for the 6% that have Giles, 72% by decision. If Bonfim can't get this down to the mat, he's a good striker. He's a really good striker. We can't stress this enough. He's a good boxer with a lot of submission wins. But if you look at it, Giles has a method of victory, and I think we made that apparent. I do have Bonfim in the matchup. For the same reason that I picked Preston Parsons to beat Trevin Giles, I think Bonfim, if it goes down, he can not wall install or just hold things in a position, but I do think Bonfim's quite adept with his grappling. For that reason, I do have him to win the fight.
I agree. I bring up that the James Krause fight on purpose. I couldn't remember his name until I put the in front of it, but for Giles, he can get held in some of those spots, and I think he will have a lot of success when he's on the feet. I think we will see a lot of 50-50 striking, just based off the activity and the jab of Giles, but I think eventually Bonfim's either going to land that big power shot or get him to the mat long enough to start threatening with submissions.
Both of us going with Bonfim in the matchup. Some big time fights on this card, as I mentioned. You have Derek Lewis taking on Marcos Sugerio de Lima. Wonderboy's taking on Michel Pereira. Some big ones that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
And now Holland finally slapping the gums. I was waiting.
He said, "Do you smell weed?"
That's what he said.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said to Papa Dio. I do smell it also.
After stutter steps or crossovers like your Alex Ovechkin from other fights to other fights, cross your fingers. Coming up this weekend, we have the Maverick, Michael Chiesa, taking on Trailblazer Kevin Holland, a guy who was ranked in the top 10 of the UFC's middleweight division, taking on a former Ultimate Fighter winner in Michael Chiesa. And if you look at this, it's crazy to see a guy that fought at middleweight to take on a guy that fights at, well,
fought at
welterweight, and then a guy at lightweight that won the Ultimate Fighter in that division up at 170 pounds. So when you consider these two guys, it's oil meets water. The fighting skills out of both the two are completely different. You have sick jiu-jitsu zone Chiesa, who's trained at Syndicate and the UFCPI sporadically to get ready for these fights. And if you look at it for Kevin Holland, bounced around a little bit, but he's always been a Travis Luter BJJ guy. And for Holland, he's made that transition down to 170. He had the Alex Oliveira performance. He had the win over Tim Means. But then a loss to Khamzat Chimaev, where UFC 279, everything got shuffled around.
Weird.
Kevin Holland drew the trap card, where Tony Ferguson drew Nate Diaz. And then, of course, Holland in the main event against Wonderboy, he ends up losing in a fight of the night. He breaks his hand, and then he just continues on, can't make it back up. So Wonderboy gets the win at the end of the fourth round going into the fifth. Holland, his last time out, a fight of the night against Santiago Ponzinibbio. He gets the win, he gets the finish, but in that one, people might forget. We touched on it a ton before Holland fought against Ponzinibbio, the fact that, listen, that hand is damaged. And then if you go back and you watch that fight against Ponzinibbio, he rarely throws his right hand. He switches stance a lot. He completely outstrikes Ponzinibbio because he establishes distance early with his jab and his kicks and his stance switches. You see the finish, and if you only watch the finish, what is it? It's a right cross that lands. Ponzinibbio backs up. Holland rushes him, throws the left hook. Ponzinibbio drops, and it's over. And Ponzinibbio kind of, you know, he protested the stoppage, but he bounced down, bounced up. If you look at it, though, yeah, Holland barely even threw his right hand through the entirety of that fight. So I'm interested to see Holland with a long time to get ready for this one. Will he start to throw that right again? Because if you watch Holland getting ready for this fight, he spent a little bit of time at Extreme Couture, and he's throwing jab, 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 jab. Uppercut, jab, 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 jab against Eric Nixick in the video. So I'll be interested to see how Holland makes out in this fight with that. And when you look at the takedown defense of Holland in the UFC, you know that's the thing that he struggled against. You know the Chiesa, it's a lot of strike to clinch to take down. And if you want a great two examples of Chiesa doing that well, look at those two wins that he had. RDA, it's exactly what he did, and Neil Magny.
Don't watch that Neil Magny fight. We did it, so you don't have to. Please don't watch that fight.
It's awful. But if you look at Chiesa in his last two fights and the losses, he loses to Vicente Luque, gets submitted really early, and then against Sean Brady. And it's been over a year and a half since he fought Brady. He got completely out-wrestled by Brady in that one. So a big-time rebound for Chiesa was due Li Jingliang earlier this year. Jingliang out due to a back injury, so Chiesa just left in limbo, and now he ultimately gets Holland as was booked.
Michael Chiesa is a really difficult fighter to break down because I would say he falls into that category of you know who he is just by watching a silhouette. And yes, that silhouette might have to, you know, be minutes long so you can see the whole totality of his game, but his game has a very strange progression to it. He's a fighter who had great BJJ coming into the UFC that was always at the forefront of his game. His offensive wrestling is good, but I do think we've seen a limitation of, hey, if you are a great offensive wrestler, you can defend some of his takedown attempts, and you can at least squirm on your back against him a little bit. Now, I would never want to be on my back with Michael Chiesa on top because he's that good of a grappler at just breaking you down and really making you work from that bottom position, and I always thought that that was a real big key to his game. I know he can go in there and get submissions, but normally he's really waiting out his opponent, tiring them out before he gets a lot of those big submission wins, and against Holland, it's going to be interesting. Because Holland is real squirmy off the back. Like, yes, he can get held down. Hamzat Chimaev submitted him. I can hear you guys in the comments already. Hamzat's a middleweight. Let's just call it what it is, and he is a one of one. For Chiesa, it's odd because his BJJ very good, his wrestling is pretty good, but the striking has been the thing that he has worked on, and we do see a lot more of it at this stage of his career than we have in the past, but I don't know if it's at a level where I really want to see that side of his game. Remember when Kevin Lee started showing up southpaw a lot, and he would always get cracked the second he'd go to southpaw? Those are the types of things that I've seen in Chiesa's game that I think have held him back from being a real top 10, top 15, because he can beat most guys outside the rankings, but when he goes against the Luques of the world, the Sean Brady's of the world, guys who can match him in his own specialty and then expose some of his weaknesses, we have seen the limitations of his game. But this is my question to you. Do you think Kevin Holland could scramble with Michael Chiesa? Because I have a hard time with that position. I know Kevin Holland has good BJJ. We've seen him in the past. But I just don't know if he's going to be able to be active enough to get out of some of those spots.
And he's so big, and he was a middleweight, but he fits in well at welterweight. And for Chiesa, he was a giant lightweight. How he made it, nobody knows. And he looked terrible on the scales when he did it. But at 170, he fits in. You watch that Chiesa fight against RDA, and you go, okay, numbers on a page. He out-wrestles RDA. That's cool. Watch what he does in that fight. Because the second round was close. The third round, Chiesa definitely won it. Go back and watch the start of the first round of that one. Chiesa, really wonky, really stiff, really trying to break his way in there, and RDA's throwing hooks around it. And until Chiesa gets in and gets it down to the mat, he does get hit. He gets hit in the second round, third round. He's kind of smothers everything with that wrestling, with the jiu-jitsu. If Chiesa can do what he did in that matchup or against a bigger, longer, rangier striker who throws straight shots and Neil Magny, then he could get a win against Kevin Holland. But I don't know how that right hand's gone on for Kevin Holland. We didn't see it against Ponzinibbio until the very end. He watched that fight. He does not throw it. So
can that not be
weird.
A positive, though? Like, he knocked out a really good striker with one hand until he landed the power shot. Like, I agree with everything.
An aged version.
Michael Chiesa fought RDA when he was 45 in MMA years. So if we're going to talk great about his performance, then we can't throw shade on the other one. That's all I'm saying.
It really is weird that way. And again, you look at both these guys, the activity from Kevin Holland in the UFC, debuts the 2018 Contender Series. He's 11-6 with no contest. Performance of the nights against Buckley, Ontivero, Jacare, Oliveira, and Means. A fight of the night against Thompson. And if you consider it for a guy like Michael Chiesa, he's gotten it done against some really, really big guys. And Holland's fought southpaws in the past. Kyle Daukaus, that fight was kind of wonky. The fight against Vittori Brunson, those are losses. Antti Vyhros will switch, but southpaw. Buckley's a southpaw. Mearshart Phillips. So he's 4-2 with a no contest against southpaws in the UFC. That's a big positive, especially coming into this fight. We'll see how the takedown defense makes out. Holland in the matchup is favored to get the win, so we throw it on over to the Tapology vote, see what the fans are thinking. I'm going to say over under 75% Holland, because I think the fans like him in this one.
I think it'll be a little bit under, but it'll be a favorite.
And it's over, so 1,237 votes, but it's close. 78% Holland, 63% by knockout for the 22% that have Chiesa, 50% by decision, 42% by submission. Those 8% of fans, and Chiesa gets the TKO over Holland. That's a bit of a surprise. But Matt, when you look at a matchup like this, who's the pick? Because I had a hard time going back and watching the tape on this one.
I do, but Michael Chiesa is 35 years old. Like, I don't think he's going to show me a bunch of parts to his game that I haven't seen up until this point. And maybe he can at least fix some of the defensive striking, because I think that's what it comes down to. If Kevin Holland can hurt Michael Chiesa enough before he gets some of those initial takedowns, then it will at least help him win rounds.
You're saying he's got to finish him early.
I don't think he does. I just think he has to put enough damage onto him to where those takedown attempts come from a few inches further away, from a foot further away, and then just makes him more available to be hit. Because I bring it up earlier just to see if Holland could scramble with Chiesa. I don't know if he's going to be able to. Like, Michael Chiesa, up until the finish against Luque, was having good success when he was able to get him on the mat and really control him. So I think Chiesa has every avenue to win this fight, but I do think Kevin Holland's going to hurt him before he gets it to that point.
Yeah, it's going to be a really tough one. I mean, even after the Holland win, when he was able to beat Ponzinibbio, the only clip out of it that I could hear him say when he was talking to Dana White and the Donald, he said, "Hurt my f***ing hand, but we're good." And then he hopped back into the cage. So for Kevin Holland, a big win his last time out. I will take him to win this fight. But again, I've seen enough clips where Holland struggles with the takedowns. Even the Derek Brunson fight. The kick and then a misstep. And then Brunson lands a straight, it was the other hand, a straight left. Holland's back on his back and then he's chirping and chatting. It'll be tough if he does that against a guy like Keith. So both of us in this one going with the Trailblazer, but really eager to see who you guys have in this matchup. You can find us iTunes, that Apple Podcast, Matt, Spotify. You can find us for that audio version as well as here on YouTube. So make sure you let us know who you have in these fights and your rate and your review, because that really does help us out. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. At UFC 291, will it be a turn back the clock moment, or are there going to be a lot of those Master Splinter pictures on Twitter and r/UFC? Because we have El Cucuy, Tony Ferguson, looking to do something to avoid a sixth straight loss when he takes on King Bobby Green, Mr. Shoulder Roll himself. When you look at it for Tony Ferguson, top level competition in all of these five fights. Now, he did get submitted his last time out against bare knuckle, or I guess boxing celebrity to be, Nate Diaz. He got submitted in that one at the very end of it. But if you look at it for Ferguson, I mean, we start off, he's taking on Justin Gaethje, UFC 249, interim lightweight strap on the line. He loses that one. He takes on Charles Oliveira, the champ to be. He takes on Benil Dariush. He takes on Michael Chandler. And then, of course, the Diaz fight. And if you look at it for Bobby Green, scratching the top 15 in these fights. He lost a couple before he had the no contest against Jared Gordon. He was winning that fight until he wasn't. The clash of heads, it is what it is. But you saw Gordon get finished in that one. You saw Green get his hand raised. But when you do consider it overall, Bobby Green's a big, big favorite in this one. Ferguson, even back in June, he had that TMZ moment. And he was out there pleading not guilty to the alleged DUI. So for Ferguson, a big spot in this one because he's kind of on a BJ Penn roll right now.
I don't think he is, because BJ Penn didn't lose to guys that were still firmly entrenched in the top 15. I know the Nate Diaz fight's a little bit different, but we bring it up for Kevin Holland against Chimaev. That whole card was reshuffled the day before it happened, so I don't know how much stock I should put into that performance, because I brought up in the Derek Lewis video, so I have to bring it up now. If Bobby Green fought everybody Tony Ferguson fought, he would get finished in the exact same way in all those fights, if not worse. And that's why I have such a hard time with where the odds are in this matchup, because, listen, you guys watch MMA like we do if you're watching this channel. You know what Bobby Green's really good at, and you know what Tony Ferguson's really good at. I don't know how Green is a justifiable 3-1 favorite, and this is why. Bobby Green is phenomenal boxing, right? We love the volume, we love the combinations, but he's not one of those one-hitter-quitter type of boxers who's really going to be able to sit down on the one shot and hurt you. And maybe Tony Ferguson's durability is so far gone to where, okay, Bobby Green can hurt him with some of those strikes, but Michael Chandler landed one of the hardest kicks we've ever seen to knock out Tony Ferguson. Ferguson was able to get out of some really difficult positions against Charles Oliveira. Like, he almost had his arm broke at the end of the first round. His arm was bent in ways that it's incomprehensible how he did not tap. I find this fight really difficult to break down because you're asking yourself, how much more does Tony Ferguson have left in the tank? And is he taking this fight thinking he's going to get back into the top 15? Or is this one of those matchups that kind of gets him put into a different rankings category? Into a, hey, you're just fighting other big names in the welterweight and lightweight division. Like, gangster weight was kind of Chael Sonnen's quote, right? Like, I'll fight you at middleweight or 205. I don't care. I'll fight you at either. For Tony Ferguson, I could see him doing kind of that two division thing. He's won the Ultimate Fighter at 170 way back when. I know that's a really hard thing to remember because it was so long ago. He was one of the better fighters at 155 pounds. I just don't know if that fight against Nate Diaz and the lack of fight out of that submission is telling or not. Because when he got put into that guillotine, the fight was kind of over immediately. And Tony Ferguson, who fought Kevin Lee, Tony Ferguson, who was making his way to the title, I think would have fought a lot more in some of those positions.
And Ferguson going into that fourth round, you had two judges, Sal D'Amato, Ron McCarthy, both out at 29-28 for Diaz. And then Junichiro Camijo coming in like Evan Bourne. Matt, you like that reference?
I do. He was the recipient of one of the craziest RKOs of all time.
Yeah, Evan Bourne over the top rope. Yeah, Junichiro Camijo, who had a 29-28 for Ferguson. He goes by Matt Seidel now. He wrestles with Ring of Honor, the stepchild of AEW.
Evan Bourne's in AEW right now.
Yeah, AEW, but Ring of Honor.
I just watched
it's
AEW.
The undercard of AEW. But if you do look at this, Matt, Tony Ferguson, I mean, the kicks, the spinning shots, the crazy fight that he had against Anthony Pettis that was fight of the year at UFC 229. You look at it, all the bonuses, he had the 12 wins in a row. He's 15-1 at one point in the UFC with a one loss to Michael Johnson, who also has a win over Dustin Poirier. But if you consider it for Tony Ferguson, five losses in a row is pretty much a black mark on your record. And at UFC 216, that was the interim title win over Kevin Lee, where Lee was having success when he moved forward. And then Ferguson caught him with a check shot, and it started to go downhill from there. If you consider it for a guy like Ferguson, though, against a Bobby Green, you have to expect some of the wrestling, where Bobby Green has really good
taste in defense. But that's the thing about Tony Ferguson. Even with all of his submission wins, a lot of them don't come from him initiating the grappling sequences. He's having a lot of success on his feet. He's throwing those weird straight shots from odd angles, and then his opponents are the ones who are forced to take him down. Like, Kevin Lee is a way better wrestler than Tony Ferguson, right? I don't think a lot of people would argue that. But Tony Ferguson's cardio, mixed with his jiu-jitsu, mixed with his level of wrestling, it's a really difficult trio to try to overcome, but that's what I have a really hard time with. Can Tony Ferguson summon that version of himself? Can he still dig down that deep to get through those difficult positions? Because against Chandler, he was doing well in the first round. He dropped Chandler with a straight shot. I really thought we were going to see the El Kikui of old, but unfortunately, seconds into that second round, it was one of the most disgusting knockouts of all time. But that's been the big problem with Tony Ferguson, other than the Benil Dariush fight. And even then, he lands a really good up kick that Benil openly admits, like, I was rocked, I was really hurt in that shot. Ferguson, even in these losses, is having a bit of success. He drops Justin Gaethje. He's having success against Oliveira. He's doing well against Benil in some spots. But it always does come down to he just can't keep that success going for 5, 10, 15 minutes. And that's what I worry about with a guy like Bobby Green. But at least him fighting Green, you don't worry about him getting a crazy amount of damage. I know he's going to eat a lot of volume, but Green isn't that one-hitter quitter like a Poirier or like a Gaethje.
The significant strike per minute numbers for both these guys, 4 and then against, 5.07 to 3.95 for Ferguson, 5.97 to 3.67 for Bobby Green. And again, Green in the UFC, Strikeforce lineage, and then he comes in. He's been 10-9-1 with an old contest since his 2013 debut, and we touched on it with Ferguson, how good that lineage is. But the fight of the nights for Bobby Green, two of them against Lando Venato, one of them against Fazeev, where he came back in the third round, and then against Drew Dober. Success, but when he was getting backed up, it was that big looping shot from Dober.
Fight against Eric Koch, too, I remember.
Eric Koch, he was the promised guy. He was supposed to be that next.
That was his real nickname.
Love that shaved head with the man bun on the top. It was cool before it was cool with Eric Koch. But Matt, when you consider a fight like this, Green is favored. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprised us there to you. Fans like Tony Ferguson, fans like Bobby Green as well. I'm going to say over, under, I think it's going to be closer than the odds, 65% Green.
I'll say it's over, but I agree with what you say. Both guys are fan favorites, and that's why I like this matchup. Like, Tony Ferguson at this stage of his career shouldn't be fighting Gaethje and Poirier, like the guys at the top of this card. But I think this fight against Bobby Green is one that fans are going to get excited for. Does the winner gain a lot? Probably not, but it's still, it's going to be a fun fight no matter what to put on the main card of a pay-per-view.
So over under 65%?
I think it's going to be over for Green.
Green, and it is over. So 1,250 total votes, 76% Green, large majority, 54% by decision, 40% by knockout for the 24% that of Ferguson, 50% by decision, and then it's a mix between submission and knockout. Matt, who do you have in the matchup?
I think El Kakui is one of the great nicknames in MMA, but I am going to pick Bobby Green, oddly enough. Again, I think if Tony Ferguson shows up the version of him that was on his way to the title, this fight isn't close. Like, that's how good Tony Ferguson was in his prime, but I just don't know if we have that same fighter in front of us anymore. It's been a lot of damage. Even when he was on his run, he would get hit by big shots. The difference was he could rebound from those big shots and have success. You bring up the Lando Venata fight for Bobby Green. The Lando Venata fight against Tony Ferguson is one of the craziest fights you'll ever see. Ferguson gets dropped on numerous occasions and ends up getting a Darce choke at the end of the first round. It's one of the craziest short fights you will ever see in your life, but even then, he's fighting an unranked guy who had not fought in the UFC up until that point. Tony Ferguson was ranked, I think it was 4th or 5th in the division at that point, and he was still having fight of the nights against guys like Lando Venata.
Negative knockdown ratio for both these guys, it's 3-4 to 5 against for Ferguson, it's 3-4 to 4 against for Bobby Green. The durability's question mark, no
Bobby
matter...
Bobby Green got dropped 3 times by Poirier, though.
Where you go, but when you do look at a fight like this, I do like Tony Ferguson in the fight. I think his last time out, he was due Li Jingliang at 170 pounds, and on a day's notice, he ends up with Nate Diaz. I was surprised that he got submitted. I was surprised that he was down 2-1 going into the fourth. I had it 2-1 for Diaz. But for me, I do like Ferguson in the matchup. Again, volume out of both these guys, a big key. And if you look at it for Bobby Green, shoulder rolling out of the way, if he's able to figure out the distance early and figure out Tony Ferguson, he has a big time method for him. So Matt, split on the pick in this one. I'm going El Kakui. You're going with King Bobby Green. Let us know what you have down below in the comment section on this one. The main card is Thompson versus Pereira. The main card also has Blachowicz versus Pereira. So you're not going to want to miss any of this action. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Strikers get down to business in Salt Lake City. Coming up this weekend, we have the former two-time UFC welterweight title challenger, 47-47 the first time, UFC 205 against Tyron Woodley. UFC 209, did Wonderboy win that fight? Well, he didn't on the scorecards, but he did in a lot of people's minds. Matt, Wonderboy looking to turn back the clock. He's a man. He's 40, and he's taking on Brazil's demolidor, Michel Pereira. And when you look at a fight like this for Pereira, a wave of success in the UFC. 6-2. Like, you look at the recent string of wins, you look at what he's been able to do. 5-0 in his last number of fights. His last time out, he gets the win over Santiago Ponzinibbio by split decision. It's a wild fight. It was a great one to go back on the rewatch. But if you look at it and consider it for Pereira, how does he close distance? I don't know, whatever he decides
like
he wants
man.
To do. It could be Rolling Thunder like Justin Gaethje. It could be anything you can think of. Superman punch, a spinning back fist, whatever. Michel Pereira's there to do it. For Wonder Boy, he had the two losses in a row that really made people question things because he loses to Bilal Muhammad and Gilbert Burns by the same fashion. He gets out-grappled. He gets worn down. He's older in his career. Now he's losing fights. But his last time out against Kevin Holland, did he accept some damage? Yeah,
he did.
But it was a wild win where Holland breaks his hand and that's the end of the fight. But if you watch that fourth round of that matchup, Thompson is going after Holland. So an amazing performance for Wonderboy's last time out. He's been on the shelf since late last year when that fight took place. He's coached a little bit on the Ultimate Fighter. Team McGregor finally got one.
Well, they need a coach, so
finally
we might as
got
well
a win.
Do it.
So Matt, for Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, he gets it done there. But just a wild career for Wonderboy
since
he came in to where he is right now for Pereira. I mean, the guy was getting it done with Road FC with those moonsaults, and now he's here. It's awesome to have both these two guys. And for Pereira, he's trained at a couple of different gyms in Vegas throughout his UFC career. Seems like a little bit mixing it up at Extreme Couture for this one. So fun there. And for Wonderboy, talk about the coaching. He had a teammate compete here recently. Short notice debut against a Brazilian fighter. Against Joe Anderson Brito, it was Weston Wilson. And that silhouette, it just burned off into the night. So Matt, Wonderboy, Pereira, we're excited about this fight. It's a battle between really flashy strikers. I know you like it too.
The weird thing about Wonderboy Thompson in those losses is that It wasn't him convincingly losing. Now, Bilal Muhammad beat the brakes off him. Yeah. The Gilbert Burns fight was a weird fight. Let's just talk about that for a second. He was doing really well at range against Gilbert, making him pay for some of those lackluster entries, but Burns would just get him stuck in some spots, for lack of a better term. Like, Wonderboy would get stuck with his butt up against the cage, like in a weird posture, and Burns would hold him there, and that would be enough for him to go out there and get a lot of rounds. But I gotta be honest, even picking Gilbert Burns in that matchup, I wasn't all that impressed by the performance, and I still think Wonderboy Thompson did a good enough job defensively, because in my mind's eye, if Gilbert Burns gets Stephen Wonderboy Thompson down for 3 seconds, the fight's over. He's that much better at BJJ. But for Wonderboy, he really has worked on that defensive side of his grappling, and we've seen that all throughout his career. I remember the two big wins that got Wonderboy Thompson put on the map. I'm gonna sound like the oldest person in the world. He fought Jake Ellenberger in the main event of an Ultimate Fighter card way back in the day, and then the fight after that was against Rory McDonald, the Red King.
That was Rory who got some chips chipped off.
Beat the brakes off him, though. And, like, really was dominant in that performance. And that's the fight that I often go back to think, okay, how is Wonderboy Thompson going to deal with different questions? Because Rory McDonald's a really good wrestler, offensively and defensively. He is a really talented striker on the outside, too. But Wonderboy, his wrestling has gotten to the point to where, unless you are, like, a Division I All-American type stuff, like, Tyron Woodley was able to take him down. Bilal Muhammad was able to take him down. But for the most part, Wonderboy Thompson's defensive wrestling has really grown leaps and bounds throughout his career. And I think a lot of guys have gone into the cage thinking, well, he's a little bit older in his career. He still goes by boy. So if I hit him one time really hard, he's probably going to go down. Look at what Vicente Luque had to go through when he fought Wonderboy.
And Jeff Neal.
That fight was a one-sided beatdown. And that's the thing. When Wonderboy really is on his game, when he's able to bounce on the edges of his feet, switch stances, and use the wide variety of strikes he's able to, there's not a lot of fighters out there who can at least match that variety and do a good job defensively against it, too.
And there's a couple of things about this fight. This was originally due for UFC 289, but Michelle Pereira, there's a soft spot there for Vancouver, right? Because if you consider, what was Michelle Pereira's marquee loss in the UFC? It was a Tristan Connolly in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
The Demons.
Where Connolly came back, he powered through it, the cardio king that he was, and he ends up beating Michelle Pereira. So you look at a guy in Pereira where it's a 5-fight win streak. He's 6-2 in the UFC. Consider the fact that, does he throw a lot of leg kicks in his fight? Because he has one fight that ended really, really quickly, and it was a tough one to kind of add into this. It's a Danny Roberts one. In the debut, he throws the flying knee. So you consider that one a little bit, but the most in terms of leg kicks that Pereira's thrown is 16, and it was his last time out against Ponzinibbio, who at times can march you down, but he's a little bit more of a stationary target. Before that, 14. But if you do an average out of all the fights, including the Roberts fight, 6.75 leg kicks per fight for Michelle Pereira. It's not a big part to his game. Wonderboy switch stance on the outside. He moves quick. Even at 40, we'll see how those leg kicks play a factor for Pereira, whether they do or whether they don't. And for Wonderboy, he did get marked up by Kevin Holland his last time out, which is a credit to Kevin Holland, but it takes away a little bit for Wonderboy because he did get hit quite a bit by Kevin Holland.
But Kevin Holland's a former middleweight who's bigger than almost everybody in this division, and he throws straight shots, which is something Michelle Pereira doesn't do, and that's why I think he's going to have a really hard time in this matchup. We've seen a lot of fighters go, like, Vicente Luque is as good of a boxer as you can have in this division, and he went in there thinking, if I hit Wonderboy a couple of times, he's going to fall. Wonderboy, when he's able to use that outside footwork and make you lean into shots, he's not a big power puncher. Like, Wonderboy doesn't have a ton of TKO victories, but when you march into his shots, when he's able to accentuate his punching power using his own footwork, it's a really difficult thing for a lot of his opponents to deal with. And if Michelle is trying to close the distance, just using those big actions and not really working his way in a methodical way, these would be really difficult for him. And the thing that we have to bring up too is Michelle doesn't have the threat of the wrestling that some of the other fighters have had. He's not Gilbert Burns and he's not Bilal Muhammad.
No.
That's all. And I think you do need to be that level of wrestler to have success against Wonderboy, because that's why I bring up Rory McDonald. Rory McDonald couldn't take the guy down, so I don't think Michelle Pereira is going to be able to.
No, and Pereira's turned down the antics as the UFC career has gone on. Obviously, the Tristan Connolly loss was a real eye-opener. You watch him fight Zalim Imadaev, who's nowhere near Wonderboy, but the example is he brought a complete and measured game plan together. You watch him fight Ponzinibbio, more of a complete and measured game plan. I had it 29-28 for Pereira in that split decision win. I thought he won the first round, the second round, but Pereira, the power bar can go down as the fight goes on, and it allowed Ponzinibbio to get back into it in the third. Now, Wonderboy is favored in the matchup. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. Fans love these two guys. They've won bonuses in the UFC time and again, and I don't think Pereira is going to get Dan Stitgened like when Thompson had his UFC debut.
One of the great head kicks of all time where he like flips it over the shoulder. Yeah. That's beautiful.
I'm going to say over under 67.5% Wonderboy.
I had it at 80% for Wonder Boy, so I think it's way over.
You look.
I did. I can't believe I hit that.
1,293 total votes, 80% Thompson, 83% by decision for the 20% that I have Pereira, 64% by decision. I think it goes to a decision. I think Wonder Boy can still do it at 40 and get a decision win in this matchup, but I think this is going to be an awesome fight.
It should be a really fun matchup, and hopefully Wonder Boy is tested a little bit like he was in the Kevin Holland matchup, because if he is on the back foot eating some damage, that's going to make this fight a lot closer. But Wonder Boy, when he doesn't have that threat of that top tier of wrestling, it does allow him to really go out there and throw a lot more kicks, because against Woodley, you can go back and watch, he's not that committed to the kicking game after he gets taken down in the first round at UFC 205. Because of the threat of the wrestling, I just don't know if Michelle has that same level, so I do think it's going to help Thompson really use his whole game.
Yeah, 47-47's out there, and you had a majority decision in the first Woodley fight.
I thought Woodley won both those fights, if you want.
Majority decision was the loss. So the first one was a draw, the second one was a loss, but some 48-47 Thompsons that were out there as well. I think it's a great fight. Both of us going with Wonder Boy, and it's last time out against Holland. Rumblings. Where are we going to have Jack Black? We're going to have Kyle Gass. Hopefully we get that for this one. That'd be great. But Matt, a big time fight in Vegas. The co-main event, Blavich taking on Pereira at 205 pounds, and in the main event, oh my, it's the rematch, Poirier-Gaethje, a fight of the year the first time. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Former champs coming up this weekend, meeting at 205 pounds, MMA Junkies Mike Bond. He fanned the flames. This is not going to be a title fight. It's a three-rounder. You have the former UFC light heavyweight champ, Jan Blachowicz, with his legendary Polish power, taking on legendary Brazilian power. You want to see a left hook. It is the former middleweight and light heavyweight glory kickboxing champ and former UFC middleweight champ, Alex Poatan Pereira, battling it out at 205 pounds. Matt, we've seen Alex Pereira up 20 pounds from middleweight, and I just said it right there. At Glory, he was the champion, and that was around 208 pounds because they do it in the metric system in KGs. And if you look at it and you consider some of the fights that he had, his last fight in 2021 was just a few months before he made his UFC middleweight debut, and he lost a really close decision against Vakitov. And in that one, I thought Pereira won the fight. I was surprised that Vakitov won. Now, that was a rematch because Pereira beat the fighter out of Russia for the title.
I don't know the judging criteria of kickboxing, and I'm going to be very honest about that.
But just overall, you go back and watch that fight, he eats a right hook in the first round. They clinch up, and he looks over to where the camera is and goes, what about it? So for Alex Pereira, you saw him meteoric rise in the UFC from Mikhailidis fight, Sean Strickland, Adesanya, he finishes him. That seemingly ends their trilogy. Two fights in kickboxing, one in MMA. They rebooked them. And Matt, back not that long ago, Alex Pereira is fighting against Israel Adesanya. It was UFC 287 back in April. And it was a second round knockout win for Adesanya. He's doing the pullback.
And that's the thing. It wasn't a TKO. It's not like Alex got hurt by a big shot, is up against the fence, and then the ref stops it before he goes out. He was out. And that's what I really do have concerns with going into this matchup, because I don't know if Jan Blachowicz is the most dangerous guy Alex Pereira has ever fought. I know that's a wild thing to say, because Jan is a former champion at the 205-pound weight class. But for Jan, he's had a bit of a run after he lost the title, and it's been an interesting one, because even in the Glover fight, he just looked kind of flat in that matchup, and when Glover was able to get that top position on him, there wasn't a lot that Jan was able to do on the defensive. Exactly, it was pretty much over the second it got to the mat. But for Jan, do you think he's going to draw confidence from that Israel Adesanya matchup? And on the flip side, do you think Alex can watch that fight and gain a little bit of confidence from it too? Because I think Jan, I don't think he's going to strike with Alex Pereira. Spoiler alert, I don't think he's going to go out there and strike with one of the most dangerous strikers we've ever seen. But everybody does bring up the Polish power about Jan. He has a lot more to his game than just that. He himself has really good kicks. The thing I like about Jan is he's a good defensive striker. I brought this up a lot before he fought Dominic Reyes. I was very adamant that Jan was going to win that fight because defensively, Dominic Reyes had not reached a level where Jan Blachowicz had reached. And he has still shown that part. He holds his hands very high. He does a great job checking leg kicks too. And that's the thing about Jan that has really gone unnoticed. He always does a really good job of getting that shin up and forcing it out. He's almost like an offensive weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, he's no Johnny Parsons, but he is very good at it.
He is very, very talented with that technique, and that's something I think he can have a lot of success with in this matchup, because if Alex is on the outside, we saw him against Sean Strickland when Sean's trying to march him down with his hands out like this, and he just gets blasted. He was throwing that leg kick on the back foot and really trying to time Sean Strickland on some of those entries. I think Jan might fight in a bare-bones way like Sean, but he has a lot more to offer if things aren't going his way on the feet.
And Jan is an interesting guy. The Rakic fight, it ended like Aspinall Blades. It was over really quickly. He had the injury to Rakic in that one. So that was the third round of that matchup. But if you do look at the fight that Blachowicz had against Ankalaev, 47-48, 48-46, 47-47, and it ends in a draw.
This is a really interesting fight. This is how I judge that fight. Feel free to disagree. The first three rounds are really, really close, and I thought Ankalaev won the last two rounds.
Yeah, so did I.
Like, if you want to say Jan won the first three rounds, I'm not going to disagree with you. They were that close. The only definitive opinion I have on any of those rounds, though, I thought Ankalaev won round four. I didn't think he did enough to get a 10-8 in round five. I saw that out there. That's why it was a majority draw. I thought he won that round. There just wasn't enough offensively from that position. But it was a weird fight because both guys did seem tentative in the matchup.
Yeah, I thought Ankalaev had won three rounds, but obviously the top brass, they weren't impressed enough. No titles for
you
guys.
It wasn't a great fight.
That's it. So ultimately, Hill takes on Teixeira shortly after. Dana White never makes decisions like that, but he did that night after UFC 282. And ultimately, Hill beats Teixeira, and now the title's vacant. That's why there were those rumblings. Mike Bond fan the flames, or at least extinguish
the Achilles on Hill.
And now we end up here. So for Pereira, 205 is the weight class. For Jan Blachowicz, I mean, he was a KSW light heavyweight champ years ago, and he's got his Gerald Meir shirt. Gerald Meir shirt's got that one bugaboo. And who is it? Jay Ellis. He's 1-1 against Jay Ellis. Jan Blachowicz, 1-1 against Sokoju. And listen, I mean, it is what it is. He ended up round two retirement when he took on Sokoju years ago. But you look at a fight like this, Matt, the odds, they're basically at par. We've seen Blachowicz wrestle in the UFC. He came into the UFC, he beats Aleir Latifi, he's
beautiful
the talk
kick
of the town. And then all of a sudden, he's 2-4 to start his UFC tenure.
He lost to Alexander Gustafsson, though, in one of those.
And now he's 10-2-1 since that mark. So a wild career arc for the now 40-year-old Jan Blachowicz. And don't forget, Alex Pereira, some road miles in kickboxing, too. He's 38 years old. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. And a fight that's a par like this, I'm going to give the edge to the man who's done more mixed martial arts. I'm going to say over-under 60% Blachowicz.
I'm going to say one last thing. I love that this isn't for the title and it's a three-round fight, and this is why. You need to see Alex fight at 205 before you give him an opportunity like that. What if he does show up a little bit flat? What if he isn't the same guy that he was at 185?
You mean a guy that got knocked out a few months ago?
But I just mean the weight class more than the actual fact, or more than the result of his last matchup. I'm happy that we are kind of not easing him in, because fighting Jan Blachowicz is not easing your way into the deep end. But I do like this matchup. At least we're going to see where he stands in the division before we start putting titles on the line. I think 60%
for
Jan
Blachowicz?
I think it's going to be over, personally.
Wow, I like it. 1,324 total votes, 51% Blachowicz, 53% by decision, 17% by submission, 23% by knockout. For the 49% that have Pereira, 84% by knockout. And when you look at Jan against wrestlers, he can knock them out. I mean, everybody remembers UFC Rio Rancho when Jan Blachowicz knocks out Beast in 25-8. He's got no time. He walks over, and then he's trying to get John Jones to bite. But John...
he's just too friendly, though.
John's not into it, so the fight doesn't happen. You look at a guy like Alex Pereira with the striking caliber, it's the leg kicks, in addition to the left hook, in addition to the fact that he can
throw... The right hand's great, too.
The right hand from different angles. The uppercut, the cross, the hook, whatever it is. He can dictate the striking in this one. And we've seen decent takedown defense in the UFC from Alex Pereira. I don't know if he can do it at 205 against Jan Blachowicz, and I'm going to go with the older man Blachowicz in the fight.
I've also got the former champion Jan Blachowicz. This is my big issue. Alex Pereira on the way up had fought Bruno Silva. Remember how good that fight was?
That fight was amazing.
It was a back and forth brawl where he lands a lot of really good shots, eats some good shots too. I just think if he gets into a matchup like that against Jan to where, okay, Jan is having some success in the feet, Jan can decide to take it to the mat. And maybe it's not just a case of, I'm going for the takedown attempt, I secure the takedown attempt, but Jan is at least going to be the fighter who can decide where this fight takes place. Maybe it will take place some in the clinch because Pereira is able to defend some of those initial takedown attempts, but I just think over 15 minutes, Jan's going to get him to that spot eventually, and from there he should have a lot of success.
And the best part about it, I get a Shohei Ohtani rookie card. He lays that trump card down. Alex Pereira, main trainer partner Teixeira, and Teixeira was able to beat Jan Blachowicz for the belt. So Matt, some amazing fights this weekend, both of us going with the legendary Polish power in the co-main event. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. It's the big time, Matt. The rematch. You got Poirier taking on Gaethje in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And it's time for the rematch up at the top. UFC 291, the BMF belt on the line. I mean, it's been vacated. Jorge Masvidal is retired. So for the first time since 2019's UFC 244, and I don't know if The Rock and Roberto Duran are going to be heavily publicized, but it's on the line between Poirier and Gaethje in the rematch. As always, one half of your host, Noah Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen, FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen. And when we look at this fight, a 2018 Fight of the Year contender, if Ferguson Pettis did not exist at UFC 229, this would have taken the cake. But regardless, an all-timer between Poirier and Justin Gaethje. When you look at this fight, Matt, I mean, Justin Gaethje had so much success in that first fight with the leg kicks. He landed exactly 50 to 11 from Dustin Poirier. Messed up the timing of Poirier, who was still able to land great boxing combinations, and we saw the finish from there in the final seconds in that fourth round. But when you look at this fight, Matt, and everything these two guys have gone on to accomplish, all the fight of the nights, all the performance bonuses, the fact that both of these guys, in addition to Tony Ferguson, won interim championships. For Poirier, it was over Max Holloway in their rematch. For Gaethje, it was over Ferguson at UFC 249. For these two guys, did they fight the same way that they fought the first time?
Gaethje doesn't, actually. That's the fight that made Justin Gaethje become a completely different fighter. The guy that we saw in the Cowboy Cerrone fight, and even the guy that we saw in the Tony Ferguson matchup later on. Because Justin Gaethje always was the highlight reel. Like, you guys know it. He still does fight like that to a certain degree, don't get me wrong. But he has tapered his style a little bit to become much more of an upright boxer, to where he's not just running in face first to a lot of these shots. This is the only zag I'm going to have. Yes, he had a lot of success with the leg kicks. He also got knocked out off a counter to a leg kick, though. And that's the big thing. Like, the left straight from Poirier hurts Justin Gaethje as he's throwing a right leg
kick. And then it's just a giant blitz.
Then it's a big blitz. But that's the shot that puts Justin Gaethje on skates and what really hurts him. And I'll be honest, even going back, and I can find this text message, I had friends that were texting me during the first matchup of these guys saying, Poirier's done, it's over, after the third round, because that's how hurt he did look. And their first fight's so good, please go back and watch it. One of the great MMA fights of all time. It truly is, because not only are these guys kind of brawlers, right, where they will eat a shot to give a shot, they're both pretty technical at this stage of their careers, too. And that's why you're not just going to go in there and see two meatheads throw big power shots. Poirier is still an intelligent defensive fighter, even though he's been hurt by some big shots, but he's also fought Eddie Alvarez twice. Like, Michael, like, his level of competition is extremely high, so you're going to get some of those losses. But the one thing I've got to bring up, how ridiculous was the conversation that Dustin Poirier didn't have a chin or durability? Like, Conor McGregor said that about him when he was at 145, and that was what the average MMA fan kind of ran with, right? Like, Poirier, he's a great fighter, but if you hit him on the chin, it's kind of over. He's completely reversed that part of his career on this run at 155 pounds. And I do think for him it was a matter of finding the right weight class, because he was almost having too much success at 145 to force to move up to 155. But ever since he's made the move, Anthony Pettis fight looked amazing. The Gaethje fight. Like, he has really redefined himself at 155.
Since losing to Conor McGregor, Dustin Poirier is 13-3 with a no contest in the UFC. The no contest, the illegal knees that were unintentional against Eddie Alvarez. But you look at it for both these guys. Gaethje comes in with a fight of the year contender against Michael Johnson, follows it up with a fight of the year against Eddie Alvarez, both of those in 2017. Gaethje has won 11 bonuses and he's had 11 fights in the UFC. The only ones that weren't bonuses for him, his loss to Charles Oliveira, and then he had one other tricky
he'll double bonus.
Yeah, that's it. He'll double bonus when that was
Habib fight was tough.
The Habib fight and then the Charles Oliveira fight. Not bonuses for Gaethje. But if you do look at it for Gaethje, whether it's a Tony Ferguson fight to win the interim championship, going for it, not giving it hoot. And if you do look at it in his last time out against Fazeev, majority decision win where? Was it a 10-8 third round for Gaethje? I didn't necessarily think so, but for Gaethje, he poured it on in that fight. The leg kicks obviously were a big difference maker. And if you go back to their first matchup, Poirier versus Gaethje, it's a big time Fox card. To me, it's actually an iconic poster. The blue and the red. You had
a good one,
Carlos
yeah.
Condit, Matt Brown. But if you look at it for Gaethje, in that one, the eye poke in the fourth round to start it off, he loses a point. And then what does Poirier do? Poke him right back. But he doesn't lose a point. But
well, Gaethje had poked him twice, though. That was the,
Gaethje
that was
had
the
poked
second
him
one,
twice,
yeah.
And that's why he lost the poke. The scorecards going into round four, including the eye poke, 28-28, 29-27 Poirier, and a weird scorecard from Sal D'Amato. It read 29-28, but it should have been 29-27 for Poirier. So Poirier ahead on the scorecards into that fourth round, but it was a really
close... momentum was not on his side going into the fourth round, though, and I'm glad you bring up the scorecards, because it really was a fight of ebbs and flows, where both guys were having a lot of success at different points, because Poirier comes out landing a ton of great boxing combinations, and really using the hand speed to hurt Justin Gaethje. And the thing about Gaethje, and you guys all know it too, Gaethje's a very simple fighter, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful way whatsoever, because in his simplicity, he is a very complex fighter. Let me explain. What does Justin Gaethje do when he gets you up against the cage? It's the same three things. He throws a right elbow, a right uppercut, a left elbow, and a left hook. Those are really the only things you have to worry about. Now, the power on those is a 15 out of 10. The speed on those is a 10 out of 10. So if you do zig when you should zag, the fight is over. But for Gaethje, it's never been this wide variety. I know he'll throw a rolling thunder, but for the most part...
He did that at the end of...
Exactly. He did that at the end of round two against Poirier. Yeah,
and it landed.
But, well, it landed. The back of his, like, shin did. Not really. But for Gaethje, he really has redefined himself as being more of a steady fighter. And I do think we have seen that, especially in the Michael Chandler fight. That Michael Chandler fight was crazy early on, but as the fight progressed, Justin Gaethje really made Chandler fight the fight he wanted him to. And this is where Michael Chandler comes into the equation. Dustin Poirier went for one takedown attempt in their first matchup after that leg was hurting him, and it kind of gets Gaethje to the ground, but they immediately pop back up on their feet because he wasn't able to secure it enough. I think Poirier is a better grappler than Justin Gaethje. Like, if these guys get down to the mat, I think Poirier has far more submissions. He's far better off his back. Look at the Dan Hooker fight. Dan Hooker gets him down a bunch, and Dustin Poirier is going for omoplata sweeps. Like, he's getting wild with it. But Justin Gaethje has that wrestling background. I just don't know if Gaethje's wrestling is going to be able to hold up to five rounds, because I do think we're going to see a little bit more grappling out of Poirier, because look at what he did against Michael Chandler. Hurts him, gets him down, and the second he's hurt, he does go for the RNC.
D1, and you know it, because, I mean, what was it? Before one of his recent fights, they had all the promos about Justin Gaethje. He's going back to the University of Northern Colorado. They're going to honor him, and they do, and we talk about his wrestling in every single fight, but he never uses it. He had that slam over Kevin Kroom years ago. Which... I'm sure people love to watch, but if you watch Gaethje fights early on, a lot of slams, a lot of big actions, and then he gets to World Series, becomes the champ, and the wrestling goes away, and the Gaethje that we know today is what comes out. If you haven't watched the Luis Palomino fights, go watch them.
Watch all of his old fights.
If you look at Gaethje, even in the Fazeev fight, he gets an actual takedown that really happened. It doesn't last for very long. He doesn't get anything out of it, but he did go for a takedown in that one. Poirier credited in the first fight against Gaethje, 0-5 with takedown attempts, 174 to 115, the significant strikes in that one. And the big thing off the leg kicks from Gaethje in orthodox stance for a right-hand dominant southpaw that is Dustin Poirier, you're always going to see he's going to open up with a 3-2 combo, but then he starts ripping to the body. And he's the type of guy that's going to go right hook to the body as well as that looping left hook as well. So look out for that from him. But for a guy in Poirier to get to the top of the mountaintop, lose to Khabib, still have crazy fights in his own volition, that's great. And you look at the guys that Poirier trains with, not just the guys that Gaethje trains with, but the guys that Poirier trains with at American Top Team.
Gamrot.
Chris Duncan. Have you ever heard of him? Yeah. I think Poirier made Duncan a hell of a fighter against Yanal Ashmoos. But Johnny Eblen, you also have Yaroslav Amosov and Mateusz Gamrot. So guys that are going to get you
into those
grappling.
And it's not just like they're in
transition.
The same gym, too. Because that can sometimes happen where guys might fight in the same gym, but they're there at different times. People have different schedules. Poirier is directly training with all those people that you just mentioned. Like, him and Gamrot are in each other's social media all the time training one-on-one.
And if you look at it for Gaethje, Onyx Labs, the gym with Trevor Whitman, I mean, former coach Thier.
A wild man.
That guy loves the striking. But if you do look at it and the guys that he's training with, we threw a picture up there a couple weeks ago for the Jack Della fight. Basil Hafez is one of those guys, in addition to Usman's. And then you've got a guy like Matt, who's the guy that trains at Ruka Sport that you know and you love, Rafa Garcia. That's the main training partner of Justin Gaethje. He's just going to put his head down and march forward and land a lot of strikes. So you look at this matchup in the first fight, Poirier -135, Gaethje +105. If you look at it right now, they're pretty much the same odds as the first fight.
Which makes sense.
And when you look at fights like this, Matt, we do get the opportunity to throw it out to you guys there in the YouTube community tab. You guys support us so well.
I'm so excited for this fight, Craig.
On the YouTubes. Yeah, and it's a great fight.
Two of the most aesthetically pleasing strikers in MMA get to fight each other for a second time after they had a fight of the year the first time around. If that doesn't sell you on this, you just don't like the sport enough.
The knockdown, the lockdown, we throw it on over to you in the community tab, Matt. And you guys have voted overwhelmingly on this poll. And if we bring it up, Matt, 1,100 votes, and Matt, 60% going Poirier, 40% with Justin Gaethje in the comments section under this one. Again, from Bob saying, super competitive, Dustin is probably the safe pick, but from the elevation last time out, it brought weird factors to fights, and I just feel like Justin is better suited. Justin and Dustin, that's going to get confusing for folks. Chandler Witt, who's always out there, I feel as if the UFC is trying to give Gaethje the advantage by fighting in Salt Lake City as he trains at elevation. BMF rematch.
Poirier's a bigger star, though, so I don't know if it's some big conspiracy to get Dustin Poirier at altitude so he's a lesser version of himself.
The biggest one, because YouTube's gone weird with these, at the Chuzzler. I don't know if I like that. Gaethje's getting revenge. People like that one. Matt, the fans kind of all over the place, 60% going Poirier. Who do you have in this matchup? Because Gaethje's continued to even level up.
I have Justin Gaethje. I didn't think I was going to say that, and I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear me say that, but until Poirier was able to land that shot that hurt Justin Gaethje, the momentum was completely on his side. He had the leg of Poirier beat up. Poirier wasn't able to throw the same level of volume moving forward as he was in the first matchup. I think this is as close of a fight on paper as you can possibly have between two ranked fighters. Look at welterweight, look at any other division. Normally, you have fighters who fight near the top. It's, hey, this guy's specialty versus that guy's specialty, right? We'll just see what wins out. Dustin Poirier, sick at boxing. Justin Gaethje, really good at boxing too. So I think this fight's going to be incredible no matter who is able to get the win. But ever so slightly, I do find myself siding with Justin Gaethje.
I mean, I threw on a Canucks jersey for this one. They call me the prop king of MMA. They call me
who
the carrot top of MMA. I don't know, you started it last week, but now it's a thing.
I say it one time, it doesn't mean that you are.
I got Creole Maple. I got the KO edition. Give me Dustin Poirier, Matt. What do you think about that?
I can't disagree with the pick. And again, if you guys have watched our channels, you guys know I seem to pick Dustin Poirier, especially when he is in the underdog position. Picked him in both McGregor fights. I think I picked him against Oliveira and Khabib as well. I just think the leg kicks of Gaethje are going to get to Poirier at a certain point. And even look at Michael Chandler. Chandler was able to have success hitting Poirier up against the cage, but Chandler gets almost a little bit too excited and then just tries to go for a takedown. Poirier, the reason I bring up the BJJ is, if you can have success grappling against Michael Chandler and Khabib and Dan Hooker, I think you can have success grappling against Justin Gaethje, and I don't think it would be a wild thing to see Dustin Poirier submit Gaethje, even though I do have Gaethje as the prediction.
I do real things in the hot sauce. Hiccups, they're a real thing. Matt, I do like that Creole Maple a lot, and I put it on quite a bit of stuff.
That's the thing. You would think if an MMA fighter makes something that he brands, you're like, hey, is it going to be that good? Dustin Poirier's hot sauce is, like, really, really good stuff, guys.
I don't do the KO edition very often because it's hot.
It's really
hot. The Creole Maple's, like, good, and we actually use it in quite a bit of stuff at the Hoss. But when you mix the two, just like I did, and trust me, I did, it's pretty bad. Matt, we're splitting the pick in this one. I've got Poirier. You've got Gaethje. People are going to think that we consult with each other on these ones because it's a close fight, but we do.
No,
see
it's
it
a close fight, so we're gonna have different opinions.
Yeah, we have different fighters in this one. Some big time fights in this card. 12 total. Make sure you toss a like for the hot sauce hiccups. I certainly appreciate everybody tuning in, Matt. This is gonna be an awesome weekend of fights in UFC 291.
It certainly will be. I'll be in London and then France, so hopefully I'll be able to watch them because the time zones are all messed up. But again, I couldn't tell you the last time I was as excited for an MMA matchup as I am for this. People might get caught up in the lightweight title, the welterweight title, titles that do signify that you are the best fighter of that division. But even if you want to care about the BMF title or not, Justin Gaethje versus Dustin Poirier as two mixed martial artists is as good of a fight as you can possibly find.
You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Into it.